covered in mud, and the pig will enjoy it.
Now You're Asking with Marion Keyes and Tara Flynn, tomorrow night at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 18th of November. This is Today with Amal Rajan in London and Nick Robinson on the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, a border that has become part of the front line in Europe's effort to halt illegal migration.
As you see, the fence is almost like 4 meters. They are very sharp and almost it's impossible to climb them with bare hands.
We are broadcasting just a few hundred metres from that fence. What happens here has a direct impact on what happens at the Channel. All this week, I'm going to be reporting on the migration routes into Europe, where people are coming from, why they're coming, and what, if anything, can be done to stop them.
And in London, the headlines this morning, President Biden has given Ukraine the green light to use American missiles to hit targets deep inside Russia. We'll speak to the former US Special Representative for Ukraine negotiations and former Ambassador to NATO, Kurt Volker, just before 8 o'clock. Sir Keir Starmer is preparing for the first meeting in more than 6 years between a British Prime Minister and President Xi of China.
Also in today's programme, we'll hear more from this border about the attempts to stop migrants crossing it and why Turkey wants welcoming to so many refugees is now turning its back on them and why they feel they therefore have to make the journey into Europe. And think of going to Glastonbury next year? Well, if you didn't get your ticket in the 35 minutes they were on sale yesterday, you're already too late, I'm afraid. Music critic James Hall laments the end of paper tickets and queues outside record shops.
Someone once told me that Prince used to plonk a giant purple porter cabin outside Wembley and he'd sell tickets on a first-come, first-served basis. Bring back the over-the-counter sales, I say.
All that after the BBC News, read this morning by Tom Sanders.
President Biden has given Ukraine the go-ahead to use American long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russia. Washington has refused for months to agree to Kiev's requests because of fears it could escalate the conflict. There was a furious reaction from some senior Russian MPs, one of whom warned it could start a third world war. President Putin has previously warned against such a move, but so far there's been no response from him. Here's our Washington correspondent, David Willis.
Referred to by their initials as ATACMS, the missiles carry 500-pound bombs and have a range of up to 200 miles. President Zelensky has been pleading with the White House for permission to use them for months, but it took the arrival of thousands of North Korean troops supporting Russia on the battlefield for President Biden to relent. Initially, at least, it's thought Ukraine's use of the missiles will be confined to defending the troops it has occupying the Kursk region of Russia. Strengthening its hand militarily, so the thinking goes, could grant Ukraine leverage in any peace talks that may lie ahead.
The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, referred to the US decision at the end of his nightly address, saying the army's long-range capabilities were a key point of his plan for victory. He said strikes were not announced and the missiles would, in his words, speak for themselves. The Ukrainian MP, Ina Sovsun, told the BBC World Service that the decision was long overdue.
We are being killed every single day. And then there are decisions that can help save lives here in Ukraine, but it just took so long to take them. So we are not worried about escalation. We are worried that it took Biden so long to make the decision that could have saved lives at least a couple of months before that.
The UK and France are expected to follow suit after President Biden's decision on long-range missiles. With his analysis, here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
UK defence officials have been making the case for Ukraine to be permitted to use Western-supplied long-range missiles to hit military targets inside Russia for months. But until now, Britain has not been willing to go it alone. The change of US policy opens the way for Ukraine to use UK-supplied Storm Shadow missiles with fewer restrictions. Washington has long argued that one weapon will not change the course of the war. Ukraine has been given limited quantities of long-range missiles from the US, UK and France, hundreds, not thousands. But this will be a significant psychological boost for Ukraine at a time when its defences are crumbling.
So Keir Starmer is in Brazil for the G20 summit of many of the world's largest economies. Downing Street says he'll urge other nations to step up their support for Ukraine or face unfathomable consequences. He'll also hold talks with President Xi Jinping of China, as our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports from Rio de Janeiro.
This will be the first time in more than 6 years a British Prime Minister has met President Xi. Sir Keir Starmer said Britain and China had to be honest about disagreements, but he also said China was the world's second biggest economy and one of the UK's biggest trading partners. He wanted what he called a serious and pragmatic engagement with the country. The aim, he said, was to increase economic growth and security at home, and he would have similar conversations with other G20 leaders. The problem is that one leader not here, Donald Trump, is overshadowing this summit. He may adopt a more aggressive approach to China and trigger a trade war if he imposes big tariffs on Chinese goods entering the US. This summit will give leaders a first chance to compare notes about what could come in January. Hard choices may lie ahead.
BBC News has found that gynaecology waiting lists across the UK have more than doubled since the start of the COVID pandemic in February 2020. There are more than 750,000 outstanding appointments. Before the pandemic, the figure stood at 360,000. Anna Cooper has endometriosis, where cells similar to those in the lining of the womb grow in other parts of the body. She's had 17 operations, but is still in pain.
The delay in my care has cost me some of my major organs. It's mentally tormented me for the most of my adult life because it's really difficult dealing with a condition where I look absolutely fine from the outside, but internally I'm just in despair.
Governments and health authorities across the UK acknowledge that women are waiting too long, but say they're working to make sure they can get support when needed. The government is setting out plans to clamp down on excessive profits being made by large companies running children's homes in England. The move is part of a major overhaul of the children's social care system. Our social affairs editor, Alison Holt, reports.
Council-run children's services are struggling with rising demand, complex cases and costs spiralling upwards. Local authorities say they are supporting more than 1,500 children, where they're paying more than £500,000 a year for individual places in residential homes. The government changes would require large companies to share financial details, so profiteering could be challenged. If that didn't happen, a law would be introduced to limit profits. Other plans would give children leaving care more support and strengthen the powers of the regulator Ofsted to tackle bad practice.
Conservationists believe a bird species found in mainland Europe and the Mediterranean is the first from the region to become extinct globally. The last confirmed sighting of a slender-billed curlew was nearly 30 years ago. Researchers say their analysis suggests there's a 99.6% chance it no longer exists.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It is 8 minutes past six. Let's get our first dose of the weather this morning, and indeed this week, with Helen Willits in the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Helen.
Hello, Amal. Good morning. The coldest night of the autumn so far. So we're getting up to -6 or -7 in some places. So it's our first Arctic blast with widespread night frost this week, but potentially some disruptive snow later today and overnight into tomorrow. Let's start the detail with England and Wales. We've got that cold weather this morning, icy in the north and the east, a little bit of patchy freezing fog as well for the Eden Valley, the Cheshire Plains, perhaps North Wales as well, but with it also some sunshine. However, for southern and western parts of both England and Wales, the clouds lingered from last night and it's giving us patchy rain, which will turn more persistent and heavy through the day as it pushes back northwestwards. And it's once that bumps into that cold air this evening and overnight that we really get that snow risk. Temperatures today, 4 to 13. Cold in the north, 13 in the south. Northern Ireland, cold, frosty start, patchy fog, hazy sunshine. sunshine, but gradually turning cloudier through this morning with some rain and hill snow into the afternoon. So probably about temperatures 6 or 7, but dropping later. Scotland starting cold, frosty. There are snow showers around, several centimetres falling, even at lower levels in the north, the far north and west in particular. So it's going to be icy, but plenty of lovely sunshine. The freezing fog clearing as we get cloud increasing from the south and west. Again, the first signs of that rain snow mix into this evening. So the big chance of snow, really, southern Scotland, across northern England, North Wales, the Midlands, parts of the Pennines and Peak District could have 10 to 20 centimetres of snow this evening and overnight.
Helen, my goodness, cold. Now, I'm talking to you from a bright and sunny Bulgaria. We're on the border with Turkey. You have a bright blue sky, and we're in a little farming village, so you may be able to hear, yes you can, the cockerels and indeed the dogs that are barking here. Why are we here? Well, we're broadcasting from the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, the external frontier of the EU. And what, you might wonder, has that got to do with you, with the argument about curbing the number of small boats crossing the channel? The answer, which we're going to explore over the next 3 years, is pretty much everything. Turkey, which is just over a 4 metre fence, a few hundred metres away from where I'm broadcasting, is home to more than 4 million refugees. And now President Erdogan wants those he once called guests to go home. Migrants without papers are being arrested and deported. Even those with them can face being harassed and abused. No wonder many who made temporary homes in Turkey want to leave, legally if possible, using people smugglers if when necessary. Ali, originally from Damascus, now living in Istanbul, showed me the TikTok videos which advertised to him the smuggler's wares.
It's a smuggler's account on TikTok. You have many smugglers having accounts on TikTok.
And it has a smart logo. There's a picture of a boat. There's a picture of a plane, and then there's a map showing some people who've obviously arrived in Greece.
This logo and the picture is to confirm to the audience that we already arrived. I'm sharing my location.
That was a sign of success. Another sign of success came here on this side of the border, here in Bulgaria, where I met Hamid, an Iranian thrown out of Turkey, who swam across a river to make it to safety in Bulgaria. He now works for an NGO which helps people who've made the same journey.
As you see, the fence is almost like 4 meters. They are very sharp, and almost it's impossible to climb them with bare hands.
These days, the fence is patrolled by border guards, monitored by cameras and by drones. But locals in this tiny farming village of Shtit, which means shield, as it's on the border, remember the times desperate families could cross the border and do it easily. I spoke to one farmer in his 70s.
He has seen a whole family of Syrian refugees, a whole family with children. They walked around here.
They were just over here.
He saw them, he called the police, and the police came and picked them up.
With little children?
Three small children on the shoulders.
On the shoulders?
And he felt very sad for them.
Yeah. Does this happen often?
It happens from time to time.
From time to time. The worry is that it may happen more often, as refugees feel that they have to leave Turkey, as some feel they don't want to make the journey over the sea. More will be tempted to put the ladders up over the fences, to try to go underneath, to swim across the rivers in order to make the dangerous journey, which gets them not just into Bulgaria, but into the EU, with the possibility of freedom and a life deeper into Europe, and maybe one day in Britain as well. Hussam, a Syrian refugee who is still living in Turkey, told me about the change in mood towards refugees that he was suffering and others faced in that country.
It was a comfortable, safe place for Syrians, but in the past few, let's say, years, it's not safe anymore for many Syrians. They're just feared of some groups of racist people who don't like refugees. Even the normal community here, they are not welcoming them, because especially in the public transportation. Let's say you're going in the tram, you cannot speak comfortably in Arabic with your phone because many incidents happened. People attacked because they were speaking Arabic on the phone. So this was a real issue for many Syrians here, so they cannot speak Arabic in public comfortably.
It is a real issue for us as well. Why? Because people smuggling is a trade. It depends on supply and demand. Keir Starmer's government tends to focus on supply, on dealing with the people smugglers. Rishi Sunak used to talk about demand. What is clear is whether it is wars, whether it is climate change, or whether it is a government like the one just over the border here in Turkey turning its back on refugees, demand is going up, not down.
Thank you very much indeed, Nick. Yeah, and what's also clear from those clips that we've heard and plenty more over the next 3 hours is just how incredibly hard this area of policy is, because it involves so many different countries coming together on shared objectives, which they actually turn out not to share all the time. Anyway, it's 6:15. Let me bring you the main story from the wider world, because there has been a significant change of policy from the US. Outgoing President Joe Biden has said that Ukraine may in fact use US-made long-range missiles supplied by America to Ukraine deep inside Russian territory. This is a significant policy U-turn. And David Willis, our North America correspondent, told me what we know so far about Biden's decision to allow Ukraine to use these weapons.
Officials here have confirmed, Amala, what amounts to a significant change of policy, and something, of course, that Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has been calling for months now. President Biden, of course, has resisted approving the use of these very powerful long-range missiles. He's been conscious of the dangers of provoking an escalation in the conflict. And they're known as the Army Tactical Missile System, or ATACMS, and they are supersonic guided missiles, which have a range of about 200 miles, I'm told. They carry 500-pound bombs and can be fitted with either cluster munitions or conventional warheads. And they're very difficult to intercept, apparently, because they travel at quite high speeds. They are one of the most potent weapons yet provided to Ukraine. And most significantly of all, they are capable, of course, of targeting logistics hubs deep inside Russia. Now, it's thought initially, anyway, that Ukraine will only be able to use these missiles to defend the troops that it has occupying the Kursk region of Russia. But that, I think, is unlikely to appease Vladimir Putin. He said back in September that the use of any such weapons would be seen by Moscow, by the Kremlin, as the participation of NATO in the conflict in Ukraine.
So why has Biden made this decision and this change of plan now?
Well, it seems President Biden's mind has been changed, particularly by the arrival of about 10,000 North Korean Special Forces troops who've joined Russia in its effort to dislodge Ukrainian forces from the Kursk region of eastern Russia. And it's thought that his decision is intended, at least in part, to deter North Korea from sending additional troop units. Joe Biden, of course, has been a close ally of Ukraine, but with just 2 months left of his presidency, he's clearly very keen to do as much as he can to leave Ukraine in a good position, or as good a position as possible, to defend itself. Donald Trump's imminent return to the White House is raising fears over the future of support from this country for Ukraine. And it's felt that strengthening Ukraine's hand militarily could help Ukraine diplomatically by granting it leverage in any peace talks that may lie ahead.
David, always good to talk to you. David Willis, thank you. Yes, we'll have more on that story from a Ukrainian MP just after 7:10. At 7:50, we're going to be talking to Kurt Volker, who was a former representative of America at the Ukraine negotiations, a key figure, and indeed Steve Rosenberg also at 7:50. But now at 6:18, it's time for the business with Sean Farrington. Good morning, Sean.
Morning, Amol. Yeah, we're going to have a look at what the energy regulator might do later this week. It's got a big decision to make about the maximum suppliers can charge households on it. standard tariff. And we've just had some fresh info from the energy consultants Cornwall Insight, closely followed. They're forecasting an increase in this price cap for the first 3 months of next year. Now, there was already a rise that kicked in last month, and according to this new modelling, the cap for a typical household's energy usage, so on a standard tariff, if you're on one of those, typical household will spend £1,736 a year on its energy. That would be the maximum it could be charged, a 1% rise on the current cap. Craig Lowry is behind the modelling, principal consultant at Cornwall Insight. Morning, Craig.
Good morning.
Why these expectations of another increase come January then?
I think really what we've been looking at is the level of movement and volatility in the wholesale market for gas and electricity over the last few months. That's had another quite variable 3 months. And really what we're seeing is that now coming out through the modelling and potentially playing out through customers' bills when the cap is announced in the coming days.
Right. Are we properly prepared for what sounds like a higher than previously expected energy cost for our households?
I mean, I think what we've seen over the last few years is continued pressure on household energy bills. Obviously, during the energy crisis, there was support from government for households. But really, what we've been looking at is prices well above the historic norms for gas and electricity, that in turn coming through customers' bills. And unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any sign of a return to pre-energy crisis levels.
No, and on that, soon. Craig, I mean, the expectations by the likes of yourself have been sort of well managed on that. We've been told that many times, don't expect to get those household bills back to where they were before the energy crisis anytime soon. I just wonder now, when you look at these numbers, are they actually, are household bills going to be consistently higher than many would have been predicting just months ago?
I mean, I think the forecasts which us and other commentators in the industry have been putting out have been indicating that, you know, we are going to see levels around £1,600 per year from the current models. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, it's certainly not a surprise, but that clearly doesn't make the challenges which households face any easier.
Looking at those global wholesale markets that filter down into household costs, when you see, as we've been hearing about this morning, the developments in Ukraine, is the war in Ukraine and how that is going at the moment changing your expectations on wholesale energy costs?
It's certainly still a factor in where the wholesale market is going. You know, we also have, in the immediate sense, expectations of what supplies are going to be like as we move deeper into winter, and there's also the broader and wider geopolitical issues, you know, such as what are we going to see from the incoming presidential administration in the States, how will the conflict in the Middle East develop, and so all of these factors are coming to play on the wholesale market and echoing into impact on households.
Craig, thank you. Craig Lowry, principal consultant at Cornwall Insights, there with that latest analysis of where the energy price cap might go next, which we will find out from the regulator later this week. And new data from the Recruitment and Employment Confederation showing there were more than 700,000 new job postings in October. So that's an increase of nearly 5% on the month before, all in the run-up to the budget. Neil Carberry, Chief Executive at the REC, joins me now. Neil, morning to you. What's this telling you about what businesses were thinking around the budget?
Well, good morning, Sean. We know, of course, that the jobs market tends to lag the economy a bit. The economy had a good second quarter. Maybe this is a bit of it. All of this is still quite a bit lower than we've seen for the last year in the run-up to this, but I think it shows that there's some underlying demand, and that what's holding maybe companies back a little from going a little further was uncertainty pre-budget. Obviously, post-budget, we'll be looking at the data this month to see how people have reacted to Rachel Reeves' announcement.
What are you, from the conversations, you might not have the official numbers yet, but how are those conversations you're having since the budget comparing to those uncertainty or certainty desires that many businesses wanted before the budget?
Well, I think there is some certainty now, and of course, whether that's good certainty or bad certainty, you can make a decision against it. I think the national insurance rise, but in particular, the lowering of the national insurance threshold, which makes part-time and lower-paid workers a lot more expensive, is a big concern. So that's certainly occupying businesses' mind right now. And of course, people are making the link between that and the employment relations, but employment rights bill, all those new rights that the government bringing forward, and just a bit worried that some of these policies are putting headwinds in businesses' way to creating jobs.
When would you expect to start to see the impact of those, one way or another, in the numbers?
National insurance obviously is April next year. One of the good things is the government's taking time to get the regulations around the employment rights bill into the right place. So we're not going to see that till 26. So certainly, I think sentiment-wise, through the first part of next year, we'll see businesses' reaction. But underlying, the macroeconomic outlook for hiring is actually pretty positive. So we think that they may bring numbers off a bit, but the 25 looks to be a better year than 24 in the labour market.
And just finally, are there certain sectors, certain areas of the country where you're seeing more strength or more weakness?
Always a big uptick this time of year with getting people their Christmas presents. So one of the things we'll see in that October uptick is Christmas hiring, and very clear that there's still a lot of skills shortfall in healthcare. That hiring's been affected a bit by NHS budgets, but certainly, you know, over 39,000 ads for nurses out there. So a lot of demand still there in the public sector.
Neil, thank you. Neil Carberry, Chief Executive at the Recruitment and Employment Confederation. If you've been watching the share price pages, the sites online, getting your updates on your apps, you'll have noticed that the defence sector has seen a bit of a rise in recent weeks. Shares in some of the biggest defence companies right across Europe have been climbing, some of them off the back of Donald Trump's re-election earlier this month. I've got Andy Thomas with me, who is Chief Executive of Cohort, which is a defence technology company that's seen its own share price rise 6% in recent weeks. Andy, morning to you.
Good morning to you.
How are events of recent weeks filtering down to the conversations you're having about contracts and investment in defence?
Well, I think what we've seen is the continuation of a trend that's really been happening since early 2022 and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Clearly, European defence expenditure has been rising since then. I was at a conference back in April in Brussels, and it was abundantly clear then that the European Union and many European politicians did not see Vladimir Putin's ambitions ending at the western borders of Ukraine. There's a genuine and real emphasis on the importance of defence spending. Now, clearly, Donald Trump has made it absolutely clear that he wants to put more pressure on the European allies to spend more. Undoubtedly, that will have an impact. But it's a continuation of a trend rather than a change of direction.
Are you still, though, awaiting for those policy decisions to come from President Trump? Could that impact where your investments may go next and who wants to do contracts with you?
We are, as an organisation, about half of what we do goes to the United Kingdom, but we're also quite a substantial exporter. I think there are sort of two major poles of demand worldwide at the moment. Plainly in NATO, Europe, demand is being driven by what's happening in Ukraine. Some countries, but many countries, are increasing their defence spending really quite radically, notably Poland. But, I mean, the UK has made a clear decision to increase its defence spending. But also we're seeing spending driven by Chinese activity, particularly its large investment in its armed forces, particularly the Navy, and some of its actions in the Indo-Pacific region and particularly around the South China Sea. So that's driving demand around Asia and down to Australasia. And you can see that, for example, in the AUKUS pact between Australia, the UK and the US to enhance Australia's security in this, you know, potentially quite difficult situation.
And if this is a moment where there is more spending going on and more opportunity for businesses like yours, are we set up in the UK to be able to capitalise on this increase in spending from governments around the world?
I think one of the things that the Ukraine war has really brought home to militaries and to governments is the importance of local supply chains. I mean, that's very apparent from what's happened in Ukraine. You know, the need to actually produce more equipment, particularly more consumables, but also more platforms, armored vehicles and so on, and more technology. There's been, an incredible race in terms of using electronic warfare to defeat threats and then, you know, building up countermeasures to that EW. Yes, I think the importance of local supply chains, being able to do that locally, whether that's in the UK or in its near neighbours, is becoming increasingly important.
Andy, thanks so much. I have to leave it there. Andy Thomas there, Chief Executive of Cohort, that defence technology company. After seven, I'm going to be looking at developments in the electric vehicle market. Car makers could well be making a case this week that do they need to quite sell as many as the government is demanding they do? We'll have a look at the detail.
Sure, look forward to that. Thank you very much indeed. It's coming up to 6:30 now. Carthy's here with some pleasing sports news if you're an England fan.
It is indeed. Thanks very much, Nick. Yeah, the interim manager, Lee Carsley, came away from his final game in charge of England with a 5-0 win over the Republic of Ireland. The result means England return to the top tier of the Nations League and have won 5 of their 6 games under Carsley.
I've enjoyed it in parts. I think the games and training have always been, you know, the best bit. I'm still gutted about the Greece game at home, honestly. I'm not really thinking about the 5 wins. It's that one that we lost, and it is a lonely place, Wembley, when you are 2-1 down against Greece.
Scotland face Poland in Warsaw, where they still have a chance of maintaining their League A status, while Northern Ireland need a draw to secure top spot in their group and earn promotion to the second tier. Chelsea are top of the Women's Super League. Rory McIlroy has won golf's season-ending DP World Tour Championship. The Northern Irish golfer finished 2 strokes ahead of Rasmus Højgaard to top the European Tour season rankings for a 3rd year in a row and claim his 6th Race to Dubai title overall, matching Seve Ballesteros' record.
To think that, you know, my name is up alongside his, it's incredible. Something I'm incredibly proud of, and something I certainly don't take for granted.
Rugby Union in Wales suffered a 52-20 defeat to Australia and Cardiff in the autumn international season. The Wales head coach, Warren Gatlin, said he agreed to whatever the best decision is for Welsh rugby, following questions over whether he will stay in the job. Great Britain's Billie Jean King Cup team have reached the semi-finals of the competition after defeating the defending champions Canada 2-0. Emma Raducanu and Katie Bolter both won their matches in straight sets. And the British captain, Anne Kiethavong, is confident ahead of tomorrow's semi-final against Slovakia.
They're highly motivated to be here. They want to be here. I'm lucky to have my best 5 players here. And we've got a goal in mind. You know, we're not quite there yet, but we're another step closer.
The men's world number one, Jannik Sinner, won the end-of-season ATP Tour title, defeating Taylor Fritz. The 3rd and final day of the November meeting at Cheltenham was overshadowed by the death of 3 horses. A British Horse Racing Authority spokesperson said, "As with all fatalities, we will seek to understand the circumstances behind each incident as we strive to continue to reduce avoidable risk in our sport." And finally, the 5th T20 of the series between England's men's cricketers and West Indies was washed out by heavy rain in St Lucia. England win the T20 series 3-1.
Carthy, thank you very much.
On BBC iPlayer.
You have few friends, Cromwell. Because of what you are, they don't know how to deal with you.
The conclusion of the BAFTA and Golden Globe winning series Wolf Hall.
The king never does an unpleasant thing. Lord Cromwell does it for him.
Starring Damian Lewis.
My patience is not infinite, neither with you nor my daughter.
And Mark Rylance.
When negotiation and compromise fail, and your only course is to destroy your enemy, before they wake in the morning, have the axe in your hand.
The new series of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light. Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Can't wait. 27 minutes to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan in London. Nick Robinson on the border between Bulgaria and Turkey. With a summary of the news back in London, here is Tom Sanders.
President Biden has given Ukraine the go-ahead to use American long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russia. He'd refused for months to agree to Kiev's requests because of fears it could escalate the conflict. The UK and France are expected to follow America's lead and begin allowing Ukraine to use their long-range missile systems as well. The decision has angered Russian politicians, but there's been no response so far from Vladimir Putin, who's previously warned against such a move. Sir Keir Starmer, who's in Brazil for the G20 summit, is expected to urge other nations to step up their support for Ukraine or face, in his words, unfathomable consequences. He'll also hold talks with President Xi Jinping of China. It's the first meeting in more than 6 years between a British Prime Minister and the Chinese leader. Downing Street says Sir Keir will seek sensible and pragmatic engagement with President Xi. The BBC has found that gynaecology waiting lists across the UK have more than doubled since the start of the COVID pandemic in 2020. There are currently more than 750,000 outstanding appointments. Before the pandemic, the figure stood at 360,000. The government is setting out plans to clamp down on excessive profits being made by large companies running children's homes in England. It says it'll bring forward new measures that will require providers to disclose their finances. If they don't limit their profits voluntarily, they'll face a legal limit on how much they can make. The move is part of a major overhaul of the children's social care system. Conservationists believe that a bird species found in mainland Europe and the Mediterranean is the first from the region to become extinct globally. The last confirmed sighting of a slender-billed curlew was nearly 30 years ago. Researchers say their analysis suggests there's a 99.6% chance it no longer exists.
Oh dear. Tom, thank you very much indeed. 25 to 7. Let's turn to that lead story that Tom Sanders mentions about Ukraine and this change in policy from Joe Biden. So President Zelensky of Ukraine has pleaded for months for US-supplied long-range missiles to be used, for the US to permit them to be used in Russia, deep inside Russia. And Biden had said no, but he's changed his mind and now said yes. Paul Adams can tell us what is going on, why there's been this change of thinking. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
So what's the idea? I mean, just to be clear about what's been announced, what was it that Biden had been saying no to and what's he now saying yes to?
Well, it hasn't actually been announced officially, although President Zelensky in his evening address last night, in a slightly coy way, did say that the missiles would speak for themselves, as he put it. So Ukraine has had these ATACMS missiles, the Army Tactical Missile System, for a little while. We don't know quite how many, but has been, as you say, desperate to use them to hit Russian military targets deep inside Russia. Without that ability, effectively, they say we're fighting with one arm tied behind our back, unable to do to Russia what Russia does to us, to hit key logistics sites, you know, way inside Russia. These missiles, with a range of getting on for 200 miles, enable them to do that. Now, our understanding is that at first, at least, they will be used to help Ukrainian troops who are currently operating inside the Kursk region of Russia, that little chunk of Russian territory that Ukraine seized back in August, and where a major Russian counteroffensive involving as many as 10,000 North Korean troops is expected possibly within days. So that is where the ATACMS will be used first.
And Paul, just tell us briefly where you are and what the fears are about possible Russian retaliation of some kind.
Well, I'm in Dnipro, which is in eastern Ukraine, some distance from the front line, but a place that was hit, along with many other cities, yesterday in that large Russian attack. As many as 20 people were killed in the course of yesterday in various Russian attacks. I think there is a feeling that this decision is long overdue. It'll enable, ultimately, the Ukrainians to stem this slow, grinding, steady Russian advance in the east, if indeed Ukraine is allowed to use the ATACMS more widely, and that it'll just strengthen Ukraine's position ahead of any possible peace talks, which, of course, people have begun to talk about in connection with Donald Trump's arrival in the White House next January.
Yeah, and his likely change of policies. Paul Adams in Dnipro, thank you very much indeed. indeed. Let's turn from Ukraine to Westminster with Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. And Henry, let me ask you one question before I hand over to Nick, who's probably got thoughts on migration for you. Just in terms of how the UK will respond to this change of policy, what does it imply for this country's approach to Ukraine?
Well, Keir Starmer spent yesterday flying to Brazil for the G20 summit, and at the start of the flight, he told reporters that shoring up support for Ukraine was at the top of his agenda for the summit. And midway through the flight, it began to emerge this decision from Joe Biden. The UK hasn't formally responded yet, but the general expectation is that the UK government will follow suit, so allowing Ukraine to use the Storm Shadow missiles that the UK has supplied deep into Russian territory. The suggestion for a while has been that the UK has wanted to do so, but not without the cover of the US doing the same. Now, important to note, there's sort of hundreds, not thousands, of these missiles that have been supplied by the UK, US and France. But the thinking in government is that allowing Ukraine to use them in Russian territory would be an important psychological boost at this critical juncture in the war.
Henry, a lot of the thinking going on behind the scenes in government is what to do about migration. And striking that the Sunday Times splashed yesterday with a story suggesting that ministers wanted to do new deals with other countries, with Vietnam, with the administration in Kurdistan, and critically Turkey, because I'm broadcasting this morning from across the border from Turkey, to try to stop as many people coming across borders and maybe eventually reaching the channel. What are your sources telling you about what is true, what's right in that story and what not?
Well, another thing that Keir Starmer was asked about on his way to Brazil was that story. And he said, anything we can do to stop people leaving in the first place is the right thing. And it's definitely right to say that Keir Starmer is taking inspiration from Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, on how to deal with this issue. She was very close to Rishi Sunak, and Keir Starmer also seems to have struck up a strong rapport with her. And when you look at what Giorgia Meloni has done, it is about paying money to other countries or striking deals with other countries in order to try to stop the problem before it even gets close to the Italian borders. So Italy has seen a 62% fall in arrivals just in the first 7 months of this year. And the Italian government believes that is because of deals they've struck with Tunisia and Libya. So with Tunisia, for example, they have supplied them with patrol vessels and also £80 million to support small businesses alongside EU money to train the Tunisian Coast Guard. So this is all stuff that is being looked at closely in Whitehall. The suggestion is that the idea of formal deals with Vietnam or the semi-autonomous government of Kurdistan in Iraq, that is perhaps not quite where the government is at yet. But we do know generally, because of the way in which the Labour opposition, as they then were, responded to the previous government's Rwanda deterrent plan, we do know that their view generally is that you need cooperation internationally to deter people at the start of the journey more than they believe in deterrence for people making that final leg of the perilous journey across the channel.
Henry Zeffman, thank you. At 19 minutes to 7, let's turn to our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe, for more on that. Nick, for governments in this region, for governments on both sides of the border we're broadcasting from today, Turkey and Bulgaria, they are keen to get British money, British support, aren't they, in order to reinforce their borders?
That's right, yes, Nick. So, you know, Turkey obviously is a huge collecting point for people from all over the world trying to reach Europe. And then, you know, they face that choice of route. So looking at it for a moment from the point of view of an asylum seeker or a migrant, they can either cross by boat, small boats, from the western coast of Turkey to the Greek islands. They can cross the land border from Turkey into Greece, 120 miles or so wide, but with a river, a very tough border fence. And then the border where you're on, the very mountainous border to Bulgaria, very challenging physically, 320 miles long, also with a fence, a few road crossings, as I'm sure you can see, but not so many. And none of these borders can you cross without the help of professional people smugglers. And from an attempt, you know, a policing attempt from the perspective of Britain trying to stop people or slow down that flow, different ways you can do that with equipment, with more fences, with night vision vehicle glasses, or with Land Rovers, as Britain's been supplying for many years to the Bulgarians.
And briefly, Nick, the reason this border matters so much is the external border of the whole EU. Bulgaria is at the edge of the EU, trying to say to Europe, trust us, we can be trusted to look after this border to make sure that people don't get in who shouldn't come in.
That's right, yeah, this 320 miles long, very tough border, and Bulgaria trying to get into the EU's Schengen zone, trying to, yeah, prove its value to the rest of the EU. It's been in the EU since 2007, but saying, look, we are, you know, an EU member, we want to play our part in stopping a border, but it's pretty impossible, I should say. I know that border pretty well, to all you can do is reduce the flow or delay people crossing. People do, in my experience, get through in the end.
Indeed, we've been meeting some of them, and we will be later today as well. Nick Thorpe, our Central Europe correspondent, thank you.
It's 17 minutes to 7. I should tell you that we'll be coming back to Nick throughout the course of this week. He's reported from elsewhere in Europe on Wednesday and Friday, of course, and also on this programme, we'll have a special report from him at 10 past 8 before speaking to the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, about this question of children in care. And we're going to turn to that question now with Catherine Sachs-Jones, who's the CEO of Become. That's a charity for children in care and young care leaders. She's joined us in the studio. But I'll just tell you a bit about this story, because there's a big package of reforms being announced this morning, and it concerns what can be done to improve care services for children. So local authorities in this country are spending nearly double what they were just a few years ago, a decade ago. Many children lack support when they leave the system around the age of 18, and meanwhile a few of the biggest providers are making very big profits, and the government says they're effectively profiteering. Catherine, thank you for coming in. Just for those of our listeners who aren't in the sector, maybe don't have much experience for it, what are the big, give us your overview, what are the big challenges that the government is seeking to address, you think?
I mean, at the moment we have a children's social care system that is an absolute crisis. We have more children in care than there ever have been, so 83,000 in England alone. And the fact is that children are not getting the love, the care, the support they need. So many children are being sent far away from their local area, sometimes hundreds of miles away. The quality of accommodation is variable, but many children are not getting the support that they need. And then when children turn 18, they often have to leave care overnight with very little notice, and one in three are going on to face homelessness.
So very little support when they leave. Why have things got so much worse so quickly?
I mean, we really have never tackled the problems in children's social care, but undoubtedly over recent decades things have got worse. There are more children going into care, so that's putting more pressure on the system. We have the involvement of private providers, and that's doing a few things. Whilst there are some great people working within the sector, there are also some significant problems. So the quality of care is variable. We hear from children placed in children's homes where things go missing, things might be stolen from them, where children are involved in county lines and gangs, where they're not being properly protected. The second thing is location. So a lot of these privately run children's homes are concentrated in certain areas of the country, not where children are, but perhaps where property is cheaper or where wages are lower. So it makes commercial sense to put properties in those places, but that's not what's in the best interest of the children.
Because it's interesting, look at the government announcement today. They say that a few big companies are profiteering here. They talk about 23% profits, and I think there's 10 big providers that do about a quarter of children's care, and then there's lots and lots of smaller providers. And the 10 big providers are often making big profits. But, I mean, in a sense, the profits wouldn't be a problem if the services were good, would they? I mean, the issue is that they're making big profits, and yet A, the services aren't very good, and B, local councils often have to stamp up the cash.
I mean, if everything was working fine, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Sure. But the fact is, it's not. You have children getting a really poor quality service, and a big issue is them being sent to different places around the country. So from, you know, Lewisham to Blackpool, for example, away from everything and everyone they know. And that's not uncommon. And that has a huge impact on children. They could be separated from their brothers and sisters. They have to move school. And that can happen multiple times, sometimes multiple times a year. And it has a massive impact on their well-being and mental health, understandably.
So those are some of the problems. In terms of the solutions that we're getting announced today, what have you seen of the government reforms that you like? And what have you seen that you still have some ongoing concerns about?
So really positive step in the right direction. You know, for too long, this issue has gone untackled. So it's welcome that the government are prioritising this so early. I think increasing transparency around the finances of some of these big providers, a really welcome step. Giving Ofsted greater powers to regulate and to tackle poor quality children's homes, again, a step in the right direction. They've also introduced a backstop so that they could put a limit on profits in the future. So I think these are all really welcome. What we need to see now is making sure that there are enough of the right types of homes for children in the right areas. So we need to encourage in the charities, encourage back the public sector, and some of that will take investment. And what we haven't yet seen is what that looks like.
But they would say they've put a lot of money into it. I mean, you know, I don't... Every day on this programme, there are people saying that X, Y, public service under huge strain, local councils are going bust, the budget was, you know, they borrowed a lot of money there, and I think they put in $1.3 billion into the sector. So, I mean, I'm speaking to the government and Bridget Phillips and the Education Secretary, who obviously cares about this subject, has made it an early priority. They'd say they're putting a lot of money into it.
And I think that's why it's right to tackle profiteering at the same time as looking at how we finance the sector. The average profit made is £45,000 per child per year. That's profit. So we have to look at that alongside looking at how we better invest that money to make sure we have the right types of homes, good quality homes for the children who so desperately need it.
Thank you very much indeed, Catherine. Catherine Sachs-Jones, CEO of Become, as a charity for children in care and young care leaders. And I'll put some of the points that Catherine raises to Bridget Phillipson at 10 past 8. Well, about 20 past 8. Thanks, Catherine.
It is now 11 minutes to 7. It's time for our guests to go home. That's the message coming from Turkey's President Erdogan to the country's more than 4 million refugees, most of whom fled from the Syrian civil war and from Afghanistan. Those that can't or don't want to make that dangerous journey back home will instead try to find a way into Europe across the sea or across the land border, which we're broadcasting from this morning between Bulgaria and Turkey. Forgive me reminding you if you've been listening for a while, but you may occasionally just hear the sound of a cockerel or a stray dog. We're in a little farming village called Shtip, which is right overlooking the border with Turkey. We can talk now to the Professor of Migration Studies at Ankara University to get a wider sense of what's going on, Professor Dr. Murat Erdogan, I stress, is not a relative of the President. Good morning to you. Why has the climate of opinion towards refugees changed so dramatically in Turkey?
You know, the number one is very important. In 2011, we have in Turkey only 58,000 refugees. And then now we are talking about more than 4, 5, 6 million refugees and then undocumented in Turkey. And then it makes huge change. And then the expectation, the beginning of the process of the Turkish society, they thought that they will go back. But now already the Turkish society recognize also they will stay forever in Turkey. And then plus we get each day more undocumented or refugees from Afghanistan, Pakistan and our neighbor countries. And then it makes, of course, a difference. And then it was also not easy to make a process management for 5 million refugees.
This means, Professor, that a lot of people want to leave the country. They don't feel welcome in Turkey anymore, which often means they have to try to leave illegally, doesn't it? What is that doing for the numbers that are crossing the sea to Greece and indeed crossing the border from where I'm broadcasting from this morning?
You know, in Turkey, their situation is not easy. Turkey is not too much rich country. I mean, if I look at the UK, the Syrian refugees number is only 12,000. And then we are talking about over 3 million only the Syrians. And then economic condition is in Turkey very bad. And then their rights is very limited. And then because of that, for them, the best option to go to European countries through the Greek islands. It is also a very understandable situation, actually. And not only the Syrians, but also the Afghani and Pakistani undocumented, they have more interest to go to European countries. And its way as Turkey, and because of that, Turkey is not only a transit country, but also a target country now.
Yes, we know that the EU gave vast sums of money to the Erdogan government in order to persuade them to keep the migrants in Turkey. Do you think that deal is effectively over, that now many Turks would really rather they went away, they went somewhere else, they did not stay in Turkey anymore?
You know, EU-Turkey deal in 2016 was a very comprehensive deal, actually. Not only the financial support to Turkey, but also political support. I mean, the negotiation for the membership and the visa liberalization or custom union update, etc., etc. But only 2 points is now functional. One is the EU sent money per year around 1 billion euro, and Turkey stopped the refugees in Turkey and keep in Turkey. But it is not sustainable. It's an externalization policy end of the day. And because of that, everybody complain about that. And I think in Turkey, the anti-Western, anti-European tendencies is more stronger than before because of this policy. And then I see no reason to make a new agreement with EU, because now the government is also under pressure because of the political situation and then anti-refugee tendencies in Turkey. It is not easy to make a new agreement with EU now, actually.
Professor Erdogan, that's very clear indeed. Professor Dr. Murat Erdogan, Professor of Migration Studies at Ankara University. Thank you.
7 minutes to seven. Let's return to our main story this morning, which is that US President Joe Biden has changed his mind. He's given the green light for Ukraine to use long-range missiles supplied by the US to strike deep inside Russia. Let's speak to Shashank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist. Shashank, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How will this affect Ukraine's war effort?
It will firstly make it a little bit easier to push back North Korean forces in Kursk province inside Russia, because that's probably where the American government is going to say these can be used initially. And then it will help Ukraine go after some, and I repeat, some higher value targets on other parts of the front, should Washington allow that. And that will include things like ammunition depots, bunkers, airfields, including helicopters on those airfields. It will not suddenly change the course of the conflict. It's not going to suddenly dramatically change things, but it will sap Russian strength. And if, as everyone believes, talks are coming at some point early in the Trump administration between Russia, Ukraine and the West, it will put Ukraine in a slightly stronger position to deal with those.
The argument that Vladimir Putin has made, I mean, for decades, is that the West, as manifest in NATO, is encroaching on Russia. And he says that this would be direct involvement, effectively, by NATO against Russia. I mean, is there something to his argument?
A way I would put it is to say this would represent deeper involvement. There's already been substantial Western involvement in helping Ukraine target many other types of weapons, including its own indigenous drone systems on Russian soil against Russian targets. There's nothing illegal about that. It's perfectly within the laws of collective self-defense as outlined by the UN Charter. This is, I will concede, a slightly different case, because the sophistication of these weapon systems, both American ATACMS, which are launched from American-made HIMARS launchers, and British and French Storm Shadow cruise and Scalp cruise missiles, which may also effectively follow if this policy move goes ahead, they require a pretty substantial degree of Western involvement in targeting assistance, both in terms of the managing the route of the missile, but also in the case of the cruise missiles, but also understanding the specific target and facilitating, you know, making sure it can really penetrate and hit the target. So in that sense, this represents a higher degree of involvement than simply passing on some coordinates to the Ukrainians. That's correct.
And one of the things I know you've written a lot about in The Economist, and indeed elsewhere, Shashank, is the broader kind of, if we zoom out the context, I mean, part of the reason for this escalation now is the arrival of these 10,000 North Korean troops in Kursk. And to what extent is actually Ukraine up against not just Russia, but a broader alliance, you know, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea?
Well, you saw that major air attack on Ukraine over the weekend, Amol. What drones were flying in that? They were Iranian-designed drones, licensed, produced in Russia. Now seeing Russia fire Iranian artillery shells and ballistic missiles, North Korean shells. So this isn't just troops, which is in some ways, you know, I think the least important contribution these countries are making. It is a whole set of defense industrial contributions that are expanding Russia's advantage on the battlefield in firepower, that is compounding Ukraine's casualties. And that is really the core problem Ukraine faces right now.
Shashank Joshi, defense editor of The Economist. Always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Now, tomorrow night, Radio 4's favourite problem solvers are back.
Marion Keyes and Tara Flynn are back on Radio 4.
Good vibes only. It's a lovely thing to strive for, but we aren't all in our good vibes eras at all times.
No, we vary all through the day.
Using their own life experiences to solve your problems.
Are you going to decide, this is my life? I only get the one.
Starting with a special episode recorded in front of a live audience.
Would you say it is weird to reuse an engagement ring from a previous relationship?
Now You're Asking with Marion Keyes and Tara Flynn. Tomorrow night at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Right, just before we go to the weather, Nick, for those of our listeners joining us now, just describe again where you are and how you're staying warm.
Well, you may hear the old crackling of a log here, Amol, because we're next to a furnace in a community centre in a tiny little farming hamlet called Shtit on the Bulgarian-Turkish border. You might even, if you're lucky, hear the odd cockerel and dog barking as well. This is the front line of Europe's efforts to stop migrants coming from Turkey.
Proper journalism. And we'll have plenty more of it throughout this programme and indeed this week. But now 7:02, let's get the weather with Helen Winnetts. Hi, Helen.
Hi there. Well, we've got winter with us. We've got snow, ice and fog this morning. Across England and Wales, that fog causing issue across northwestern England down towards the Midlands right now. It's a frosty start as well. A hard frost, the odd patch of ice around as well. It's a different story, though, across the southwest and south of Wales, where we've got the overnight patchy rain with us. That will just turn more persistent and heavy as we go through the day and push back northwards. So temperatures today varying from 4 in the sunshine in the north once that fog clears to 10 to 13 in the south and west. Northern Ireland, frosty and cold with freezing fog first thing. The cloud comes in through this morning, followed by rain and hill snow as we go into the afternoon. So temperatures actually will be struggling to get much more than 5 or 6 here as well, and a breeze, chilly east breeze picking up. And for Scotland, we've got the snow showers in the northern and western Isles north of mainland, so you might wake up, for example, in Aberdeenshire to snow this morning. And it's cold, widespread hard frost, but sunshine otherwise before the cloud comes in towards tea time. Now, that weather front I talked about in the south and west, as that pushes its way into that cold air this evening and overnight, that's when we have that snow risk, potentially 10 to 20 centimetres over the likes of the Peaks and the Pennines. So it's certainly one to watch. Stay tuned to the forecasts.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today with Amol Rajan and Nick Robinson.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 18th of November. The headlines this morning. President Biden has lifted the ban on Ukraine using long-range US missiles to hit targets inside Russia, a move Vladimir Putin had warned against. We'll hear from our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg at 10 to 8. Sir Keir Starmer is preparing to meet China's President Xi, the first British Prime Minister to do so for more than 6 years. Gynecology waiting lists across the UK have more than doubled since the start of the pandemic.
Coming up in the next hour, I'm reporting from the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, the border between the EU and the rest of the world. Whilst other routes for migrants going to Europe are decreasing, this route, the Eastern Mediterranean route, is increasing, with people coming over the mountains to where I'm broadcasting from this morning, or going over the sea to Greece. I met Hamid, one of those who's made this journey here illegally into Bulgaria.
So after I leave the town in Turkey and walking for almost half a day, I reached to the river. And this river was very wide and I have to swim on it. I was preparing myself, so I had big plastic bags to put my stuff on it.
Much more on that after the news, read this morning in London by Tom Sanders.
President Biden has given Ukraine the go-ahead to use American long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russia. The decision marks a significant reversal in US policy after Mr. Biden refused for months to agree to Kiev's requests because of fears it could escalate the conflict. There was a furious reaction from some senior Russian MPs, one of whom warned it could start a third world war. But from President Putin himself, there's been no response so far. From Dnipro in eastern Ukraine, our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
President Zelensky has been pushing for this moment for months. When it finally came, he was a little coy. Strikes are not made with words, he said in his nightly address. Such things are not announced. The missiles will speak for themselves. It's thought that initially Ukraine's use of the Army Tactical Missile System, known by its acronym ATACMS, will be confined to defending Ukrainian troops still holding on to a small chunk of Russian territory in the Kursk region. A major Russian counteroffensive is expected there within days, assisted by as many as 10,000 troops from North Korea. Use of the missiles, capable of targeting military facilities deep inside Russia, could complicate Russia's efforts, enabling Ukraine to hold on to this valuable bargaining chip ahead of any possible peace talks next year. Ukrainian military experts have welcomed Washington's decision, saying it won't necessarily change the course of the war, but will restore a little balance at a time when Russian forces are creeping forward all along the Eastern Front. It's a significant move ahead of another long, hard winter. But yesterday's Russian missile and drone attacks, which killed as many as 20 people, served as a stark reminder that Moscow is still intent on winning the war on its terms.
The UK is expected to follow suit after President Biden's decision to reverse policy on long-range missiles. With his analysis, here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
UK defence officials have been making the case for Ukraine to be permitted to use Western-supplied long-range missiles to hit military targets inside Russia for months. But until now, Britain has not been willing to go it alone. The change of US policy opens the way for Ukraine to use UK-supplied Storm Shadow missiles with fewer restrictions. Washington has long argued that one weapon will not change the course of the war. Ukraine has been given limited quantities of long-range missiles from the US, UK and France, hundreds, not thousands. But this will be a significant psychological boost for Ukraine at a time when its defences are crumbling. Kyiv has been conducting its own long-range strikes on targets inside Russia with domestically produced drones. Now, it won't be acting alone.
Sir Keir Starmer is in Brazil for the G20 summit of many of the world's largest economies. Downing Street says he'll urge other nations to step up their support for Ukraine or face unfathomable consequences. He'll also hold talks with President Xi Jinping of China, as our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports from Rio de Janeiro.
This will be the first time in more than 6 years a British Prime Minister has met President Xi. Sir Keir Starmer said Britain and China had to be honest about disagreements, but he also said China was the world's second biggest economy and one of the UK's biggest trading partners. He wanted what he called a serious and pragmatic engagement with the country. The aim, he said, was to increase economic growth and security at home, and he would have similar conversations with other G20 leaders. The problem is that one leader not here, Donald Trump, is overshadowing this summit. He may adopt a more aggressive approach to China and trigger a trade war if he imposes big tariffs on Chinese goods entering the US. This summit will give leaders a first chance to compare notes about what could come in January. Hard choices may lie ahead.
BBC News has found that gynaecology waiting lists across the UK have more than doubled since the start of the COVID pandemic in February 2020. There are more than 750,000 outstanding appointments. Governments in all four nations say they're working to improve the situation. Our health correspondent Catherine Burns reports.
Before the pandemic, the waiting list for gynaecology stood at 360,000. When COVID came, it rose quickly, and now at over 750,000 has stayed stubbornly high. This is for appointments for consultations, tests and surgery for conditions including endometriosis, which gets worse the longer it's left untreated. It's hard to know exactly how many patients are on the list because some people could be waiting for more than one appointment. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists says women's health is constantly deprioritised and points to persistent gender bias. Governments and health authorities across the UK acknowledge that women are waiting too long, but say they're working to make sure they can get support when they need it.
The government is setting out plans to clamp down on excessive profits made by large companies running children's homes in England. The move is part of a major overhaul of the children's social care system. Our social affairs editor, Alison Holt, reports.
Council-run children's services are struggling with rising demand, complex cases and costs spiralling upwards. Local authorities say they are supporting more than 1,500 children, where they're paying more than £500,000 a year for individual places in residential homes. A 2022 report from the Competition and Markets Authority suggested the 15 largest care home providers made an average of nearly 23% profit a year. The government changes would require large companies to share financial details so profiteering could be challenged. If that didn't happen, a law would be introduced to limit profits. Other plans would strengthen the rights of families to be involved in decisions about a child going into care and give more support to young people leaving the care system.
The energy regulator will make a decision later this week about the maximum amount that suppliers can charge households on a standard tariff. The energy consultants Cornwall Insight are forecasting there'll be a 1% increase in the price cap for the first 3 months of 2025 to £1,736 a year. Craig Lowry, a principal consultant at Cornwall Insight, told us fluctuations in the energy market were to blame. Conservation groups believe that a bird species found in mainland Europe and the Mediterranean is the first from the region to become extinct globally. The last confirmed sighting of a slender-billed curlew was nearly 30 years ago, as Rebecca Drought reports.
The slender-billed curlew is a shorebird. It breeds in western Siberia before migrating to the Mediterranean in winter. But there's not been a confirmed sighting since February 1995. Extensive efforts across decades to find evidence of the bird in its breeding and non-breeding ranges have all proved unsuccessful. Although this species hasn't been declared extinct by the official body, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the researchers behind today's paper say their analysis suggests there's a 99.6% chance it no longer exists.
Items belonging to the comedian Eric Morecambe, including telegrams from Prince Philip and letters from Margaret Thatcher, are to go up for auction in the new year, more than four decades after his death. The collection includes his glasses, joke books, ideas for sketches, and the piano he practiced on before the Morecambe and Wise Christmas special, featuring the conductor Andre Previn.
Tom, that would be a treat to have, wouldn't it? Thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past seven. We'll smash the gangs, Keir Starmer promises. Rishi Sunak used to pledge to stop the boats. All too often, though, the debate about whether either slogan is really deliverable begins and ends at the English Channel. This morning, we're broadcasting from hundreds of miles away, from a border hundreds of miles away, the border between Turkey and Bulgaria, between the EU and the wider world. Why? Because what happens here along this border matters to us. It matters to what happens in the Channel too. Because like all trades, the people smuggling trade depends on demand and supply. Demand is strong not just because of war and climate change, but also because countries like Turkey no longer want to act as home to those their president calls guests, the millions of refugees who were welcomed into Turkey after the wars in Afghanistan and Syria. The number of people crossing to Europe, therefore, through this route from Turkey, either into Greece or Bulgaria, has steadily risen in the past few years, while other routes are in decline. And once they make it into the EU, many migrants will then want to travel deeper into Europe and some also to the UK. Then we turn to supply. The boats that cross the channel are all too often manufactured in Turkey. They come across this border with Bulgaria before making their way into Germany, then to France, and then over the water. Now, this morning I'm broadcasting from a tiny farming village. You might hear the odd sound of a cockerel or farm dog during the next couple of hours. It is called Shtit for a reason. That means shield. It's a few hundred metres from a huge fence meant to keep the migrants out.
So here we are.
This is the fence. We were searching for it very far away, but actually it was just very close.
My guide to the border is Hamid, a man who escaped from Iran to Turkey and then found himself thrown out of that country and decided to cross this border to make his way to safety in Bulgaria. He works now with an NGO that helps others like him who've made that journey.
I feel like we're at the top of the world now. We can see all the way around us.
Yeah.
Rolling hills, this tiny, really almost disused village here, isn't it? The odd farm, houses that have collapsed. So, this is Bulgaria?
Yeah. At the south we can see the Turkey, and at east it will be Greece.
So this is also the border of the EU?
Yes, the first border of EU. As you see, the fence is almost like 4 meters, but the wire is not visible from here, but because I know I crossed it, I saw it from close distance, you can see that there is wires on it, that the diameter is 1 meter, so half meter outside from left, half meter outside from right.
Yeah, so it's not just going up in the air, it's sticking out.
Yes,
as well.
Also at the top it's even become more. So they are very sharp, and almost it's impossible to climb them with bare hands.
So what, you have to use ladders?
Usually they're using ladders. But there is some places that they already cut it, and sometimes there is pipe under it to gather the water. And yes, there is some bar on it, but they cut also the bars.
So when you came across this border, you didn't cross this fence. What did you do instead?
So after I left the town in Turkey and walking for almost half a day, I reached to the river. And this river was very wide, and I have to swim on it. I was preparing myself, so I had big plastic bags to put my stuff on it, and I was swimming like more than a minute to cross this river.
So everything you own, you're either wearing or it's in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
On the river.
On the river, yeah. Everything was there.
We'd been here at this border for just a few minutes when a patrol car pulled up. Two police officers in uniform came to say they'd seen two men and a woman, my producer, looking over the border. Who were we? They wanted to know what we were doing. What was our intention?
This is forbidden to picture on the other side. This is agreement between Bulgaria and Turkey. Is forbidden from Bulgaria to picture to Turkish side and from Turkish side to Bulgarian side.
Okay.
Can picture all of you.
Ah, no, this is me talking to the camera. Thank you. Good to talk.
Good day.
This village is called Shtit, which means shield, a shield on the border. It's a place of dirt roads, of rundown farms, of falling down houses, dogs barking. Only the old are left here now. But one farmer in his 70s says he's seen the people cross the border. He's met the people, desperate people, coming with their children.
He has seen a whole family of Syrian refugees, a whole family with children. They walked around here.
They were just over here. Just here.
Yes, they were just over there. And he saw them, he called the police, and the police came and picked them up.
With little children?
Three small children on the shoulders.
Oh, on the shoulders.
And he felt very sad for them.
Yeah. And does this happen often?
Yeah, it happens from time to time.
Now, this I did not expect. In this tiny, rather rundown village, is a rather wonderful restaurant with a warm welcome and a chef called Nikolai. Nikolai, we're right on the border here.
Yeah?
The border with Turkey.
Yes.
Do you see many migrants try to cross the border?
I feel very safety on this place.
You're safe?
Because here many more policemen.
In the past, there were a lot of migrants that came here.
Before 3 years, many more refugees, but now it's not.
Now not?
Now not.
Because the police?
Yes, and protect area.
They protect the area, they have cameras?
Cameras, Frontex, policemen of Germany, of Poland, and different Europe countries.
What, you might wonder, has all this got to do with the arguments about stopping the boats or smashing the gangs that bring people across the channel to Britain? The answer, quite simply, is everything. when countries like Turkey turn their back on refugees and want them to leave, they head to Europe, and some, inevitably, want to make their way to the UK. And what's more, the boats that cross the channel are made in Turkey. They cross the border here into Bulgaria, eventually to Germany, where they're stored, onto France and the Channel Tunnel. So as month in, month out, the numbers crossing the channel still increases, a government promising to do something about it has to care what happens here amidst these rundown houses along this dirt road, along this border that divides Europe with the world beyond.
17 minutes past seven. Let's turn to elsewhere in Europe now, because President Biden has given his approval for Ukraine to use long-range missiles supplied by the US to strike Russia. And for months, President Zelensky has been urging the restrictions on the missiles to be lifted. Let's talk now to Maria Ionova, who is a Ukrainian MP representing the European Solidarity Party and a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Ukrainian Parliament. She's in Kyiv. Good morning, Miss Ionova.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. What difference do you hope this new policy from President Biden will make to Ukraine's war effort?
Truly sad, missiles are not the silver bullet against our common enemies. And that is why we are asking all our friends that we need to change in strategy. Because our enemies are united, and we should stand together as well. Because when I said that the enemies are united, I'd like to remind about BRICS summit, where we saw the strategy, the plans, the agreements have been signed also in the military sphere. That is why, of course, when we are talking about this permission, yes, we appreciate, but that will not bring a victory.
Yeah.
As we really need strategy, and that is why air shield above Ukraine, more trainings, more Western military instructors in Ukraine, more sanctions, and also more secondary sanctions. And I think also we should be, and our friends, leaders should be more creative, more brave. Do not exclude anything, do not postpone, because unfortunately we understand the procedures in democratic societies, but for us, time, it's human lives.
Yes, I was going to say, and just on that point about human lives, I should say, Ms. Ionova, I know from talking to colleagues and reading up about your own experience, you've lost family and relatives in this war, haven't you?
Unfortunately, yes. And I can tell you that even this morning, my nephew went to the task for 2 days. And I'm just waiting for his message every minute, because it's still for his group a very high risk if he will be back. And we have, you know, we have a huge number of people who are missing. And unfortunately, the percentage of missing people, usually it's killed people.
Yes.
And in this regard, we are that nation which would like to have peace as soon as possible yesterday. But unfortunately, we are not able to get this peace to defeat Russia, first of all. And that is why we are talking, and we are coming back again to the question about the strategy.
Okay, Miss Maria Ionova, thank you very much indeed. We'll return to this subject at 10 to 8 with our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, and Kurt Volker as well, who's been involved in negotiations with Ukraine. But for now, thank you very much indeed.
It's coming up to 21 minutes past 7 now. Ministers will meet with the big UK car makers this week to discuss the challenges they're facing, particularly when it comes to EVs, electric vehicles. Sean's back with more on that.
All about, Nick, the mandate rules, the zero emission vehicle mandate rules that they say car companies must sell a certain percentages of electric vehicles or face fines. So this year, 22% of sales must be new sales, must be cars, 10% must be electric vehicles for cars, 10% for vans. And that goes up each year until the ban on selling new petrol and diesel vehicles comes in 2035. Robert Forrester runs Vertu Motors, got more than 200 dealerships around the UK. Robert, what impact is this having on the car market right now, these mandates?
It's having a major impact on the profitability of manufacturers. They've invested billions in electric vehicle car plants. They're having to discount, I mean, billions. We reckon about between £1.5 and £2 billion of electric vehicle discounts. So they're not really making any money. And the car market is down because the demand for electric vehicles is not there. So to hit these quotas to avoid these fines of £15,000 a car, that the manufacturers are having to constrain the supply of petrol and hybrid cars. We're into rationing.
Given the quotas are all part of that path, the journey to get to 2035 and a complete ban of the new petrol and diesel car sales, do you think that is still achievable by 2035 then?
I don't think 2035 is the issue. In fact, the Labour manifesto puts the ban at 2030, which is a completely different matter. It is the speed of the transition. Next year, as you say, the quota for electric vehicles is 28%, and it goes up to 80 or 100% in 2030. The technology and the economics and the pricing of electric vehicles just do not allow the market to get there. That's why we're seeing the UK car market go down. That's why we've got the manufacturers threatening effectively to impact their investments in the UK.
When you talk about rationing going on of petrol and diesel sales, how is that playing out for customers?
Well, the natural demand is far more for petrol and hybrid cars than for electric vehicles, but the market supply, because of these government quotas and fines, is completely the reverse. So we've had cars, petrol cars at dealerships with customers wanting to take them. We've not been able to supply them, and they've been sat on the forecourt for longer because of the quotas.
Right. And just finally, Robert, the likes of BT, SSE, investing huge amounts in infrastructure for EVs. If there's wavering on these targets, doesn't that create the uncertainty we hear businesses don't want that could reduce investment?
Not at all. Everyone agrees with the path. It's the speed at which the government are forcing in something that coerces customers and, frankly, puts the manufacturers into crisis.
OK, Robert, thank you very much. Robert Forrester there, who runs Vertu Motors, one of our biggest dealership businesses around the UK.
Sean, thank you very much. It's 23 minutes past seven. Is Parliament getting enough time and following the right processes ahead of the potential legalisation of assisted dying, or assisted suicide, as many opponents of the reform call it? It's one of the biggest potential social reforms this country has undertaken in decades if it goes through. And the question is, to what extent do those things, the time, the processes, matter when this is an issue of conscience and principle? Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, has said he's minded not to support the bill in its current form, and he has commissioned an impact assessment. This is, by the way, something called a private members bill, which is not the same thing as a government bill. Let's speak to Harriet Harman, former leader of the House, former mother of the House, co-host of a podcast called Electoral Dysfunction with Ruth Davidson and Sky's political editor Beth Rigby. And also with me in the studio is Nikki DaCosta, former director of Legislative Affairs at Number 10. Good morning to you both. Nikki, if I could start with you, given you're here and in front of me, is Parliament getting enough time?
In my view, no. For a bill of this complexity, it's 40 pages, and where the kind of unintended consequences you might have are very severe. Private members' bills typically in the House of Commons get about 11 to 14 hours of debate. It's on a Friday. We don't tend to get a very good turnout, and the amending stages are really minimal. The first one, committee stage, this is when you go into the detail of the bill, that's largely controlled by whoever the sponsoring MP proposes. And typically for PMBs, they'll sit for maybe one session. They can't take oral evidence, they can't take written evidence. And report stage, when all MPs can look at the detail, might be at best 5 hours. That's not a lot of time. The Lords, we can go into lots of detail here, but the Lords is told often, please don't get involved in this bill, because if you do, you might time it out and kill it. So you get lots of pressures on MPs and peers not to do their job because of the parliamentary pressures. If the government wants to do this, bring it into the main programme, improve the process, give it enough time for debate.
Harriet Harman, given the magnitude of what we're talking about, the issues at stake, what is there anything you object to in what Nikki's just said?
Well, I think if the process was going to be as Nikki described it, I think that would be completely wrong for a matter as important as this. And as you said, Amol, this is a huge piece of socially liberalising legislation up there with the ending of capital punishment or permitting abortion. But I think the government have made clear, both the Leader of the House, Lucy Powell, and also Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, have made it clear that this bill will have as much time as it needs. So there will be a second reading on a Friday, and that's to decide the in principle decision of should this bill go ahead for consideration. It will then go upstairs in the House of Commons to committee, and it will have as many days as is necessary. And Nikki's right, it's a 38-page bill. It needs a great deal of consideration. It will then come back down. So that's as many days as is necessary in consideration. It will then come back down to the floor of the House of Commons, where all MPs can debate it and put amendments down if they're not satisfied with the safeguards. And that can be a number of days. And I don't think the government is showing any signs of wanting to restrict the debate. It then goes to the Lords. The Lords will give it priority. And again, there will be sufficient time for debate. The only time constraint is this needs to be finished by November next year, when there's the expectation there'll be another King's Speech.
I should tell
so
you,
it needs to have been finished by then.
I should tell our listeners, Harriet, that you're joining us down the line. I can see Nikki da Costa's face, and she's grimacing as she hears that. Nikki, why?
A number of reasons. The private members' bill, there are only a certain number of Fridays, so it's not that there's lots of time. If the report stage doesn't conclude in 5 hours, then actually it goes to the back of the queue, so lots of argument. I mean, look, just genuinely, you just have to look at the statistics. These private members' bills don't get a lot of debate. They are very limited. And if you are going to get this right, I mean, just take an example. Most of them don't actually get a lot of amendments made. So if you have selection, for example, at committee, I know we're going to the weeds here for your listeners.
The weeds matter.
But at committee report stage for the MPs, only certain amendments will be selected. In a five-hour debate, that means you might make some big changes, but lots of the smaller, detailed changes that might be needed, they won't happen because that's a restriction there.
OK, and Harriet, can I ask you about... I suspect you're not going to agree on the process, but on a principle, Harriet, do you think...
Well, I think we do agree on the process. We both agree there should be enough time, and the question is whether the government's going to enable that to take place.
But do you agree that there is enough time on the current plans?
Well, there aren't any current plans, and this is not any old ordinary private members' bill, and the government have indicated they will give it enough time. So I think that's just to be seen, but I'm confident they will.
Nikki, briefly, that's
the Leader of the Commons took this question on Thursday, and they have not committed to 2 days in report. They have not committed to as much time as Harriet suggests. That is not a statement that the government has made.
Harriet, can I just ask you a final, quite important point? Do you think it's important, Harriet, that the government takes a neutral stance on this matter of conscience? And if you do, what do you make of the fact that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has not taken a neutral stance on it?
Well, I think it is important that it's a neutral stance. This is a decision which shouldn't be debated by party political considerations or by the government position. It should be an individual conscience matter for each individual MP. And in order to clear the space for individual MPs all to make their own decision, the government has to remain neutral.
So what do you make of Wes Streeting speaking out on it and saying he's against the bill in its current form?
Well, I do think that he's crossed the line and has given the impression that the government is not neutral. And I think Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, set out in his letter to Cabinet Ministers last month exactly what the position is. He says the government will therefore remain neutral on the passage of the bill. At the dispatch box, ministers should reiterate this is a question for Parliament on which the government is to remain neutral. Outside of Parliament, all ministers should take the same approach in all forms of media, including social media. Though ministers need not resile from previously stated views when directly asked about them, they should exercise discretion and should not take part in the debate.
Why is it right that that should be required of our politicians? If we elect politicians to have opinions, why should they not speak out on something they care very strongly about?
Well, because the danger is that if government ministers, especially the Secretary of State for Health, if they speak out, then the government's position of neutrality is compromised, and then individual MPs will be feeling as if they have to support the government or be against the government. And this principle of neutrality on moral issues is very important indeed. Nobody wants to think that it was this particular government position that dictated how individual MPs voted. So I think that, and I think the second point is that it shouldn't be decided on money. This should be decided on a moral issue. It's not whether it's going to cost the NHS money or save the NHS money.
It's whether it's the right thing to do. Right.
It's exactly the same as if with capital punishment, you didn't decide it on the basis of whether it would save the Home Office money
or the
Ministry of Justice money to have capital punishment rather than keep people in prison for life.
I just want to put that final thought to Nikki da Costa. Go on.
Cabinet Office's guidance is very, very clear. When the government adopts a position of neutrality, it must be on the back of an impact assessment, which must look, for example, at the impact on public services. Two services are affected here: the NHS, which the health sector is required to implement these stages, and the justice system, the high courts. So that impact assessment is meant to be done before a position of neutrality is adopted, for the simple reason: this is not a debate on the principle of assisted suicide or assisted dying. It is on the principles of the bill, the details of what is in the piece of paper, because the government must take the consequences. They sign up to sign implementing it. And on that basis, it's about what the legislation actually does. And you're getting a lot of sleight of hand to say that this is actually just about the broad brush principles.
Nikki Da Costa and Harriet Harman, thank you both very much indeed.
It is 28 minutes to 8. It's time for the sport. Here's Garthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. The England interim manager Lee Carsley finishes his time with the national side with 5 wins from 6 games after England beat the Republic of Ireland 5-0 last night. The result means England return to the top tier of the Nations League. We can speak to the BBC's football correspondent, John Murray, who was commentating at Wembley yesterday. John, it has been an interesting 3 months for Carsley. What kind of England side is he leaving for Thomas Tuchel, who is the England manager in the role permanently from January the 1st?
Yes, it's all come at him quickly, hasn't it? He did tell us, Lee Carsley, last night that he and his staff are now going to spend the next couple of days reviewing their 6 matches. They're going to put together a document on it, and then he's going to meet Thomas Tuchel to talk it all over. He did often say, Lee Carsley, how it was part of his responsibility to show the incoming manager what he's going to have at his disposal, and I think he's done that. He's used 32 players in these 6 matches. He handed out 8 debuts. And he made decisions like leaving out Harry Kane, as he did in Athens, that have smoothed the way should Thomas Tuchel want to do the same thing. I think losing the home match against Greece, which they did last month, still niggles him. He was talking about that over and over again last night. But in the end, this, if you like, autumn interregnum where we've had post-Southgate, pre-Tuchel, has turned out to be a success for Lee Carsley.
I like the fact that you've used the word interregnum, having just been told off on Five Live for using it, saying it was too much of a radio forward. Carsley's been very honest about how challenging the role is. I've been out of my comfort zone, but not beyond my capabilities, he said. He has told us a little bit about that job in terms of the pressures that the managers face, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's something of a quiet man, Lee Carsley. He is more at home in his tracksuit than he is in front of the microphone. And I don't think I saw him in a shirt and tie at any point during his tenure. There is no hiding place when you're the England manager. And now he will go back to his role as the under-21 coach, which he's contracted to the end of the season. But I think he's shown that he was able and prepared to make bold decisions. He wasn't left wondering. I'm not sure it was his intention, but it has put him in the most public of shop windows, and it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest were he to become a future manager of yesterday's opponents, the Republic of Ireland, who, of course, he won 40 caps for.
Yeah, has been interesting. John Murray, thank you very much. A couple of other football headlines. First, and Scotland face Poland in Warsaw, where they will still have a chance of maintaining their League A status. Northern Ireland do need a draw to secure the top spot in their group and earn promotion to the second tier of the Nations League. And Chelsea are top of the Women's Super League. Headlines from other sports. Wales suffered a 52-20 defeat to Australia in Rugby Union's Autumn International Series. The Wales head coach, Warren Gatland, said he agreed to whatever the best decision is for Welsh rugby. Rory McIlroy has won golf's season-ending DP World Tour Championship and tops the European Tour's season rankings for a third year in a row. And Great Britain's Billie Jean King Cup team have reached the semi-finals of the competition after defeating the defending champions Canada 2-0. The fifth and final T20 of the series between England's men's cricketers and West Indies was washed out by heavy rain in St Lucia. England win that T20 series 3-1. Is it? I think it's quite nice that there was rain in St Lucia that meant the cricket finished, just because it's raining here.
Nice to have the rain. The
makes me
rain
feel better.
Makes you feel better. Well, that's the most important thing, as ever. Thanks, Carthy.
It's not funny, it's true.
Lily Allen and Makita Oliver.
Keats, I've got some questions for you.
On BBC Sounds.
Tell me what you've enjoyed about our podcast so far.
I like that you've got more and more comfortable in this space, and I've watched you show all parts of yourself.
We've both cried.
Miss Me with Lily Allen and Makita Oliver.
We're just us having a chat.
Feels like we've been doing it forever.
We kind of have.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather now. Cloud in the west and south with outbreaks of rain in the afternoon. Cold and bright elsewhere. Here on the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, it is bright and sunny. And Amal, they've just put another log on the furnace in our little community centre here. So we're toasty, which is good. It is coming up to 23 minutes to 8. And it's time for a summary of the news from Tom Sanders.
US officials have said that President Biden will allow Ukraine to fire long-range missiles supplied by Washington deep into Russian territory. The decision marks a significant reversal in American policy after Mr. Biden refused for months to agree to Kiev's requests because of fears it could escalate the conflict. There was a furious reaction from some senior Russian MPs, one of whom warned that it could start a third world war. But there's been no response so far from President Putin himself. So Keir Starmer is in Brazil for the G20 summit, where he's expected to call on other leaders to step up their support for Ukraine. He'll hold talks with President Xi Jinping of China. It's the first meeting in more than 6 years between a British Prime Minister and the Chinese leader. BBC research has revealed that waiting lists for gynaecology appointments across the UK have more than doubled since February 2020. Records show around 750,000 women's health appointments are waiting to happen, up from 360,000 just before the pandemic. Health ministers across the UK say they're working on plans to improve the situation. The government is setting out plans to clamp down on excessive profits made by large companies running children's homes in England. Its key proposal is to require the largest providers to share their finances with the government so that profiteering can be challenged. The move is part of a major overhaul of the children's social care system. The Indian capital Delhi has introduced more measures to combat worsening air pollution. Most diesel lorries are banned from entering the city and all construction work on public building projects has been suspended. Items belonging to the comedian Eric Morecambe, including telegrams from Prince Philip and letters from Margaret Thatcher, are to go up for auction in the new year, more than four decades after his death. The collection includes his glasses, piano, joke books and ideas for sketches.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Coming up to 21 minutes to 8 now. When millions were fleeing the war in Syria and Afghanistan, Turkey threw open her arms, offered a home to more than 4 million refugees. But now Turks are restless, and President Erdogan has spoken of his guests going home. Those without papers are being arrested and deported. Even those with them can face harassment and abuse. And as a result, a growing number do want to leave Turkey, not to go home, but to go to Europe, either over the sea to Greece or over the mountains to Bulgaria, from where we're broadcasting from this morning. This route, the so-called Eastern Mediterranean route into Europe, is the one that is growing, while others, including the one I reported from about a year ago, from Africa to Italy across the Mediterranean, those routes are in decline. Now, we're in a tiny farming village here called Shtit, or Shield, as it sits on the border of Bulgaria and Turkey. But before coming here, I spent the weekend in Istanbul, where Syrian refugees told me how things have changed in the place they once thought they might call home. Amar is a Syrian refugee.
No, in Turkey, the things works different from Europe. What's considered racist in Europe is considered nationalist, normal nationalist speech in Turkey. You should always, like, realize this.
When you think back to those dreams you had, what, 12 years ago, if I told you then you would be here in Istanbul, you would feel subject to racism, you would still want to escape, what do you think you would have thought?
Loss, like I have wasted my life by wrong choices. And the other feelings, like what have we done to face all of these terrible things? Like, you accepted the fact that your life destroyed back there, you want to start from zero, but you are still facing endless difficulties for nothing, not because you have done anything wrong, just because there are some politicians wants to use you, and there are a lot of racist people.
So 12 years in Turkey, but still, it doesn't really feel like home.
To speak of the most important sense of belonging, sense of minimum level of safety, no. Every time I feel there is a new hope, then it's destroyed harshly later on.
Amar isn't the only one feeling like Turkey is no longer their home. Many, like Ali, who I spoke to in Istanbul, are beginning to look elsewhere.
وعايش باسطنبول وعم اشتغل باسطنبول.
It's tough here in Turkey, especially if you don't have a degree. Also, you have risks of being deported because now I have a different ID, which I cannot stay in Istanbul. It's different province, so I cannot work legally here. You have many risks of being stopped by the police here.
So are you now planning to leave Turkey?
Of course, I'm thinking about, absolutely, I'm thinking about leaving. Not just me, all my friends. This is what we are talking all about right now.
As you'll hear, at 8:10, Ali went on to show me the TikTok videos from people smugglers that showed exactly how he could make the journey from Turkey into Europe. Well, listening to that is the former EU ambassador to Turkey, who knows all about the deal that was done by Europe to try to persuade Turkey to manage its borders, to control the flow of migrants potentially out of the country into the EU and perhaps beyond to Britain. Mark Pierini, good morning to you and thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Do you feel, as I was discovering in Istanbul, that things have changed, that the mood in Turkey, where there are so many migrants, has now changed?
Yes, indeed. We've seen several phases. When this whole thing started in late 2011, Turkey said, open arms, as you mentioned, and we'll do it by ourselves. I remember when I went in November 2011 to say goodbye to the then foreign minister, I offered EU support to Turkey for what was a trickle of less than 10,000 Syrians. And he said, no, we'll do it by ourselves. But 4 years later, when the Syrian army was crumbling in front of the rebellion inside the country, then conscription started in to be implemented in a very harsh way. So young people, young men, those with most money to flee, started going. And they went to Turkey, and this is when the problem became acute, and this is when the deal with the EU was done in March 2016. That was initially very good.
Mm-hmm. What implication do you think, I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Pierini, what implication do you think there is now for Europe, for the UK indeed, beyond the EU, of the fact that Turkey is now a less welcoming home, and indeed for many Syrians is now seen as hostile? Do you think it's inevitable that there will be a greater flow of migrants trying to make that journey across the mountains here to Bulgaria, across the sea to Greece?
Well, it is probably inevitable if you ask people, as you have done yourself. Syrian refugees in Turkey have, over the past few years, become the scapegoats of the ruling party, the AKP, defeat in local elections in 2019 and 2024, this year in March. And this is nothing to do with the Syrians. It's inflation, wrong economic policies until they were changed in the summer of last year. So a whole xenophobic narrative has been developed by the authorities, and therefore, as your interviewees have said, there are controls, you feel insecure and so on. So they will try. The problem is
Let us end, if we could, Mr. Pierini, because time is a little short, with potential solutions. Is the only solution for governments in the EU, perhaps Britain as well, to give money to Turkey to say, look, we want you to try harder to make people feel welcome and indeed to check they can't go over the border? Is that the only route?
It is probably, I would say, the main route, because meanwhile, anti-immigration sentiments have grown in Europe along with the progress of the hard right parties on the continent. Return has become a policy, or at least a template. So some of this will happen. It will be difficult, and once again we will see refugees subjected to local politics, not just in Turkey, but in the EU as well. And
Mark Pierini
in Britain.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. The EU ambassador to Turkey there. And of course, Amal, when we're discussing this, we're always thinking of the the moral, the humanitarian condition of migrants facing these sorts of challenges, as well as what is perceived often back at home as, in inverted commas, a threat of people moving across the continent or indeed moving to the UK.
Yes, and we'll talk about that moral dimension, both after your package at 8:10, Nick, but also on the podcast this week, which I know we were recording early at 9:00 on Wednesday. I know it's a busy week for you, Nick, and we're going to get as much from you as we can. But now at 8:14, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Professor Mona Siddiqui, an academic and broadcaster at the University of Edinburgh.
Good morning. I have a very modest following on Twitter, now X, but like millions, I use the platform to share personal updates, follow breaking news, public debates and funny memes. X has become a far more controversial site since Elon Musk took over in 2022. But with news of him being offered a place in President-elect Trump's government, many celebrities, newspapers and public organisations have left the site and migrated to other sites, in particular Blue Sky. They claim that their values no longer align with X, but I do wonder how long this search for a new community of like-minded people who make you feel seen and safe will actually last. These virtual public squares are set up for connecting and networking. Some use the word community to convey a sense of belonging. But a central aspect of belonging is to feel good in a place. While for many, X is no longer a feel-good place, any platform which is used for information can also be used for disinformation. The addictive and fragmented news nature of social media, its potential to provide anonymity and very little accountability, has emboldened people to use these platforms not only for extreme views, propaganda and disruptive ideologies, but to transform civic engagement and, as is often argued, hold democracy hostage. But social media has become an intrinsic part of our democratic landscape, and healthy democracies thrive when people come together not just to agree, but more importantly, to disagree, online and offline. Hollow outrage, personal attacks, and lashing out aren't signs of healthy disagreements. Learning to disagree well can be stressful, and in real life we often try to avoid it, but it remains essential for a more meaningful existence. Excessive communication hasn't led to a greater fellowship, but maybe it's because too often we believe only what we want to believe. There's a Quranic verse which says, "If someone who wants to do evil brings you any news, verify it so you don't harm people unknowingly and later regret what you've done." I think the challenge is whether we really want to know the truth or whether it's easier to believe what makes us comfortable. Social media is designed to give us digital hits, emotive content, and doesn't encourage us to verify anything. It's a powerful tool to broadcast our views, but it should also make us look within ourselves. That even though political and personal conflicts are part of our lives, how we react, what we say to each other, and how we make others feel is a moral question for us all.
That was Thought for the Day with Professor Mona Siddiqui. It is now 8:10.
Well, the story leading many newspapers and websites this morning concerns President Biden because he has given his approval for Ukraine to use long-range missiles supplied by the US to strike Russia. For months, President Zelensky has been urging the restrictions on those missiles to be lifted, and now they have. President Putin has previously warned that such action would be tantamount to direct participation by NATO in the Ukraine war. And this decision by Biden, it's a U-turn, it's a change of policy, follows the arrival in the Kursk region of Western Russia of about 10,000 North Korean troops to support the Russian cause. And in a moment, we're going to speak to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, who's in Moscow. But first, Kurt Volker, former United States Special Representative for the Ukraine negotiations, former ambassador to NATO, joins us now on the line from Vienna. Mr. Volker, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us and thank you for making the time. And I know there are a lot of claims on your time. Is this change of policy long overdue?
Absolutely. This is something that only entered our lexicon because the Biden administration decided it. There's nothing in international law. There's nothing that says there's a 60-kilometer or 100-kilometer range that's okay, and anything longer is not okay. The strictures of international law is that, first off, it's in self-defense, and secondly, attack only military targets. That's what we should have stuck to begin with, rather than creating this kind of made-up limitation that we're now finding it awkward to remove.
What kind of difference do you think this will make to the conflict?
I think it'll cause Russia to be a bit more cautious in how it strikes Ukraine and where from. It's going to allow Ukraine to go after the airfields, the ammunition depots, the fuel supplies, the logistics that Russia has, which right now are in a sanctuary zone inside Russia. And they will now have to spend some time and effort protecting those. And when they try to use them, when they light up, if you will, to do so very cautiously, because Ukraine now has the ability to strike them.
Can we interrogate the claim that Vladimir Putin makes, which is that this would be tantamount to direct participation by NATO in this war? Would it?
Yeah, he says that about everything. And it is his aggression against Ukraine, which is a military attack against Ukraine from all over Russia onto Ukraine. And he should have anticipated that there would be efforts by Ukraine to fire back. We're not firing. We're not using U.S. troops. We're not launching these things. We're giving Ukraine the weapons, and they are choosing to defend themselves.
Is it slightly bizarre, do you think, Mr. Volker, that this change of policy has been announced in such a public fashion? I mean, I don't think there's been a statement from the White House, but I mean, we know, and we've verified as the BBC and other news outlets, yeah, that this is happening. And it rather gives Russia advance notice, doesn't it, of potential Ukrainian strikes?
Absolutely. It is giving the Russians advance warning that this is coming. And secondly, it is making a public debating point out of this policy, which, again, should never have been put in place to begin with. It should have just been quietly removed.
To what extent do you think Russia and what's happened here with these North Korean troops amassing in Kursk, to what extent is Ukraine, fighting not just Russia, but really a new anti-Western alliance? You could call them the Crinklies. So China and Russia and Iran and North Korea.
Hadn't heard Crinklies before. That's good. I think that there is increasing alignment between Russia, North Korea, and Iran. In particular, Iran provides the drones that Russia uses to attack Ukrainian cities and civilians every night. North Korea has already, for a very long time, been providing Russia with a majority of its artillery shells. The introduction of troops is actually a fairly minor thing compared to the other things they're doing. Russia burns through anywhere from 1,200 to 1,500 troops a day. So 12,000 North Korean troops will replace 12,000 Russian soldiers in just a matter of a couple weeks.
Okay. One of the points we try and make on this program and elsewhere is that really what we are talking about here is President Putin's reinvasion of Ukraine. Because, of course, he actually invaded Ukraine a decade ago when he stole Crimea by violence in 2014. And there's a lot of people, I think you included, who said that Putin's greatest ally has always been time. I mean, do you think as time goes on, Western support for Ukraine is in fact faltering?
No, not yet. I think that it has been surprising, actually, how much the West came together with resolve to support Ukraine after Russia's full-scale invasion. It was the determined defense of the Ukrainians themselves, which people hadn't anticipated, that was both inspiring and very successful, that led the West to come together, that led the West to support Ukraine in the way that we have. Now, you're right. It's nearly 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion, and Putin has been counting on Western fatigue. I don't think we're quite there. And in fact, after 3 years, we're seeing signs that the Russian military is suffering its own fatigue and the Russian economy is suffering its own fatigue. Ironically, that kind of sets it up well for incoming President Trump, that Putin may now be ready to take a pause in the war, which is exactly what Trump is trying to do by pushing for peace. But even as President Trump has said, you got to have peace through strength. And these kind of self-restrictions do not convey strength. Removing them and showing that we are going to continue to support Ukraine, that will show strength and possibly bring Putin to the table.
Kurt Volker in Vienna, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's go to Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor in Moscow. Steve, morning from London. How has this news been taken in Russia overnight?
Predictably, an angry response. I was reading the website of the Russian government paper this morning, and it declared that President Biden had taken one of the most provocative, uncalculated decisions of his administration, which risks catastrophic consequences. There's been an angry response from senior Russian politicians, the head of a pro-Kremlin party, called the decision a serious escalation that could have serious consequences. Of course, Western leaders would argue that it's Russia escalating here by deploying North Korean troops, right, against Ukrainian soldiers. And a senior Russian senator called it a step towards World War III. But what counts really in Russia today is what Vladimir Putin will call it and how he will respond to it. He said nothing last night, but he has said plenty before on the matter because, you know, go back to June. Moscow's been sending all kinds of signals and warnings and messages, call them what you will, to the West. You know, just don't do this. Don't lift restrictions on the use of your long-range weapons. Don't let Ukraine strike deep into Russia with these missiles.
And you say go back to June, of course, as you often reported for us, Steve. Go back decades. Vladimir Putin's made one argument for decades, which is that Russia is being encroached upon, attacked and humiliated by the West, as manifested by NATO. And this will strengthen his argument as he sees it.
Well, yes. I mean, this is the problem that, you know, the Kremlin has complete control of the media landscape here. It controls the narrative and it turns everything to fit that narrative. So, yes, when you switch on Russian state television, you will hear that precise argument that this is another step in Western attempts to destroy Russia. And I'm sure we're going to hear that in the days to come.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor in Moscow, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Now, tomorrow's 6:30 comedy is prescribed by Kiri Pritchard-McLean.
Best medicine. Dissecting funny and fascinating medicine.
I think pain management is the best medicine.
Bibliotherapy. Therapy by books.
Sleep.
Oh. Well, spot the comedian. Celebrating medicine's past, present and future.
I think transplantation is the best medicine because it can completely change someone's life.
Defibrillation.
Oh, defibrillators, okay. Amazing machines, that much is clear. Sorry, clear! That's the new series of Best Medicine with me, Kiri Pritchard-McLean. Tuesday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 2 minutes to eight, and here is Helen Willits with the weather. Hi, Helen.
Amal, thanks very much indeed. Our first significant cold snap of the winter, widespread frost and disruptive snow potentially as well. Let's start the detail with England and Wales. A cold start. We've got some freezing fog, which is causing travel problems on the M6, I believe. Once that lifts, plenty of sunshine for many, although the south and west already have a cloud, patchy rain, and that will just become more extensive and heavy as we go through the afternoon. The cloud meandering its way across many parts, across the Midlands into East Anglia as well. So temperatures just 4 or 5, where we've had the frosty start in the north, 10 to 13, where we've got the slightly milder air still further south and west. But it's that rain coming in through this evening and overnight as it bumps into our cold air, really anywhere from the Midlands, North Wales, northwards into Northern England, Southern Scotland, where we have the risk of some disruptive snow, 5 to 10 centimetres over relatively low hills, even a few centimetres at lower levels as well. Northern Ireland getting possibly to 5 or 6 today, a cold and frosty start though, some patchy freezing fog, but all the time the cloud will increase. And as we go through the afternoon, that will bring in the first spots of rain with some snow over the hills here. A chilly east wind as well. And Scotland, snow already in the showers in the north, and it's a frosty start as well. Plenty of sunshine, though. It's not until the evening when we start to see the first signs of that rain and snow mix, particularly into the south. But as I say, all to play for overnight. Don't make this the last forecast that you listen to today.
Thanks for the warning, Alan. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday the 18th of November. The headlines this morning. The UK and France are expected to follow suit after President Biden gave Ukraine the green light to hit targets inside Russia with long-range US missiles. Sir Keir Starmer is to hold talks with China's President Xi, the first such meeting for a British Prime Minister in more than 6 years. Waiting lists for gynaecology appointments across the UK have more than doubled since the start of the COVID pandemic.
In the next hour of the programme, I'm broadcasting this morning from Europe's frontier, the front line of efforts to curb a growing trade, a growing route for desperate migrants who want to make the journey from Turkey, which they once regarded as their home, into Europe, either across the sea to Greece or here across the Bulgarian border. They tell me how smugglers are using TikTok to advertise their wares.
You have many smugglers having accounts on TikTok.
And it has a smart logo. There's a picture of a boat, there's a picture of a plane, and then there's a map showing some people who've obviously arrived in Greece.
More and more people want to make that journey, and it's not just migrants who are crossing this border. The boats themselves are often manufactured in Turkey. They come across the mountains through Bulgaria to Germany and France. We're going to be speaking to the UK's National Crime Agency about how it is trying to tackle people smuggling to try to reduce the numbers crossing the channel. All that after the BBC News, read this morning by Tom Sanders.
President Biden has given Ukraine the go-ahead to use American long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russia. The decision marks a significant reversal in US policy after Mr. Biden refused for months to agree to Kyiv's requests because of fears it could escalate the conflict. There was a furious reaction from some senior Russian MPs, one of whom warned it could start a third world war. But from President Putin himself, there's been no response so far. From Dnipro in eastern Ukraine, our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
President Zelensky has been pushing for this moment for months. When it finally came, he was a little coy. Strikes are not made with words, he said in his nightly address. Such things are not announced. The missiles will speak for themselves. It's thought that initially Ukraine's use of the Army Tactical Missile System, known by its acronym ATACMS, will be confined to defending Ukrainian troops still holding on to a small chunk of Russian territory in the Kursk region. A major Russian counteroffensive is expected there within days, assisted by as many as 10,000 troops from North Korea. Use of the missiles, capable of targeting military facilities deep inside Russia, could complicate Russia's efforts, enabling Ukraine to hold on to this valuable bargaining chip ahead of any possible peace talks next year. Ukrainian military experts have welcomed Washington's decision, saying it won't necessarily change the course of the war, but will restore a little balance at a time when Russian forces are creeping forward all along the Eastern Front. It's a significant move ahead of another long, hard winter. But yesterday's Russian missile and drone attacks, which killed as many as 20 people, served as a stark reminder that Moscow is still intent on winning the war on its terms.
The UK is expected to follow suit after President Biden's decision to reverse policy on long-range missiles. With his analysis, here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
UK defence officials have been making the case for Ukraine to be permitted to use Western-supplied long-range missiles to hit military targets inside Russia for months. But until now, Britain has not been willing to go it alone. The change of US policy opens the way for Ukraine to use UK-supplied Storm Shadow missiles with fewer restrictions. Washington has long argued that one weapon will not change the course of the war. Ukraine has been given limited quantities of long-range missiles from the US, UK and France, hundreds, not thousands. But this will be a significant psychological boost for Ukraine at a time when its defences are crumbling. Kyiv has been conducting its own long-range strikes on targets inside Russia with domestically produced drones. Now, it won't be acting alone.
Sir Keir Starmer is in Brazil for the G20 summit of many of the world's largest economies. Downing Street says he'll urge other nations to step up their support for Ukraine or face unfathomable consequences. He'll also hold talks with President Xi Jinping of China, as our diplomatic correspondent James Landale reports from Rio de Janeiro.
This will be the first time in more than 6 years a British Prime Minister has met President Xi. Sir Keir Starmer said Britain and China had to be honest about disagreements, but he also said China was the world's second biggest economy and one of the UK's biggest trading partners. He wanted what he called a serious and pragmatic engagement with the country. The aim, he said, was to increase economic growth and security at home, and he would have similar conversations with other G20 leaders. The problem is that one leader not here, Donald Trump, is overshadowing the summit. He may adopt a more aggressive approach to China and trigger a trade war if he imposes big tariffs on Chinese goods entering the US. This summit will give leaders a first chance to compare notes about what could come in January. Hard choices may lie ahead.
BBC News has found that gynaecology waiting lists across the UK have more than doubled since the start of the COVID pandemic in February 2020. There are more than 750,000 outstanding appointments. Before the pandemic, the figure stood at 360,000. 27-year-old Vimbai Mandaza suffers from daily pain. It's been going on for years, but she doesn't have a diagnosis yet.
Sometimes I feel like I'm a prisoner to my womb. It's caging me in. I don't have the words to describe the level of pain. It's literally just as simple as I want a hysterectomy because I'd rather, I feel everything and I'd rather not feel anything, if that makes sense. I'm not getting any help or any understanding.
Governments and health authorities across the UK acknowledge that women are waiting too long, but say they're working to make sure that they can get support when needed. The government is setting out plans to clamp down on excessive profits made by large companies running children's homes in England. The move is part of a major overhaul of the children's social care system. Our social affairs editor, Alison Holt, reports.
Council-run children's services are struggling with rising demand, complex cases and costs spiralling upwards. Local authorities say they are supporting more than 1,500 children, where they're paying more than £500,000 a year for individual places in residential homes. A 2022 report from the Competition and Markets Authority suggested the 15 largest care home providers made an average of nearly 23% profit a year. The government changes would require large companies to share financial details so profiteering could be challenged. If that didn't happen, a law would be introduced to limit profits. Other plans would strengthen the rights of families to be involved in decisions about a child going into care and give more support to young people leaving the care system.
Domestic energy prices are being forecast to edge up again in the new year. The respected forecaster Cornwall Insight is predicting that the typical household would pay £1,736 a year from January, a 1% rise on the current typical annual bill. The regulator Ofgem will announce the next official quarterly price cap later this week. Craig Lowry, a principal consultant at Cornwall Insight, told us fluctuations in the energy market were to blame.
What we've been looking at is the level of movement and volatility in the wholesale market for gas and electricity over the last few months. That's had another quite variable 3 months. And really what we're seeing is that now coming out through the modelling and potentially playing out through customers' bills.
The last surviving military veterans of the UK's nuclear bomb tests of the 1950s and 60s are appealing to the Prime Minister to meet them as part of their campaign for more recognition of what they say is the serious damage to their health. The men who are planning legal action say recently disclosed documents add weight to their suspicions of a decades-long cover-up, something successive governments have denied. Here's our home and legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
It's 72 years since the UK exploded its first nuclear bomb in Australia. To this day, surviving veterans or their descendants are adamant that they and their families have suffered cancers, birth defects and other illnesses linked to radiation. In the last year, the men and their campaign say they have discovered what appear to be long-forgotten documents that suggest military chiefs had been monitoring their blood all along. They're trying to relaunch a legal case that was stopped for lack of evidence 12 years ago. But time and age is against them. They're appealing to Sir Keir Starmer's government to authorise a limited inquiry to investigate whether the nuclear programme's chiefs hid evidence. The Ministry of Defence has said ministers are looking hard at the question of records.
There'll be a special film about the men, Britain's nuclear bomb scandal, on BBC Two at 9 p.m. on Wednesday. Conservation groups believe that a bird species found in mainland Europe and the Mediterranean is the first from the region to have become extinct globally. The last confirmed sighting of a slender-billed curlew was nearly 30 years ago, as Rebecca Drought reports.
The slender-billed curlew is a shorebird. It breeds in western Siberia before migrating to the Mediterranean in winter. But there's not been a confirmed sighting since February 1995, when it was spotted in Morocco. Extensive efforts across decades to find evidence of the bird in its breeding and non-breeding ranges have all proved unsuccessful. Although the species hasn't been declared extinct by the official body, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the researchers behind today's paper say their analysis suggests there's a 99.6% chance it no longer exists. Its disappearance, they say, is a stark warning of the need to tackle the loss and degradation of inland grassland and wetland.
Items belonging to the comedian Eric Morecambe, including telegrams from Prince Philip and letters from Margaret Thatcher, are to go up for auction in the new year, more than four decades after his death. The collection includes his glasses, joke books, ideas for sketches, and the piano he practiced on before the celebrated Morecambe and Wise Christmas special, featuring the conductor Andre Previn.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's 11 minutes past 8. Good morning from a tiny Bulgarian farming village, a place of dirt roads, tumble-down cottages, farms filled with rusting machinery. I'm broadcasting this morning from a community centre where they're putting logs onto an open furnace. We're here because this place, Shtit, stands atop the border between the EU and the wider world, between Bulgaria and Turkey, a country that is turning on the millions of refugees that made it their home, which is one reason more and more are trying to escape. Escape into Europe, across the sea to Greece or the mountains to here in Bulgaria. More and more is being spent on trying to stop them doing it. The border, just a few hundred metres away from me, is protected by 4 metres of razor wire. Terrifying it looks. It's monitored by cameras and drones and regular border patrols, one of which has just stopped at our little location here to check what we're up to and that we won't take photographs of what we see. There are, though, still plenty of those who do make that route across. Those like Hamid, an Iranian refugee, who stood with me and pointed out what else there was to see beyond the glories of the rustic beauty, the rolling hills, the wide fields.
At the south we can see the Turkey, and at east it will be Greece.
So this is also the border of the EU?
Yes, the first border of EU. As you see, the fence is almost like 4 meters, but the wire is not visible from here, but because I know I crossed it, I saw it from close distance, you can see that there is wires on it, that the diameter is 1 meter, so half meter outside from left, half meter outside from right.
Yeah, so it's not just going up in the air, it's sticking out
as
well. Yes,
also at the top it's even become more. So they are very sharp and almost it's impossible to climb them with bare hands.
Which is why the people who do cross use ladders, or they cut the wire, or they swim across a river where there is no wire to cross. Now, the reason people are willing to take that sort of risk, to spend thousands of dollars to pay smugglers either to come across the land or across the sea, is not just that they don't feel safe in Turkey, because many Syrians do still feel safe, but that, like migrants the world over, they dream of a better life in a richer country to give them a securer future for them and their families. In the Turkish city of Istanbul, just around 150 miles from here, I met many Syrian refugees to understand what was going on, beginning with Mohammed, who has twice tried to make that journey.
لا هوني نحنا طبعا جروبات موجودين منتفق مع الشخص اللي هو.
So it was a smuggler. He asked us to put the money in the third party, which both of us would trust and would know. So we put the money, $4,000, and we don't know the smuggler, we don't know his name, we don't know his shape. We get in a car, closed car, and they took us to the border.
I've come to a cafe and shisha bar in Esenyurt, a district of Istanbul that not just has the most Syrians in this city, but the biggest population in Turkey as a whole. In the corner, they're playing rummy with tiles instead of cards. People are drinking coffee. They're smoking. I've come here to meet Mohammed, who's tried to get out of this country not once, but twice. The second time, crossing the border with Bulgaria, paying smugglers to help him do so, but having to cross a potentially dangerous river to get to Europe, to get to a new life.
في أماكن طبعاً النهر له مواسم فمواسم يكون الماء.
You have to walk after crossing the river. You have to walk for 48 hours, sometimes more. But in our case, after 24 hours, we were spotted by the Bulgarian patrol and we got captured.
من مساكن فما تعرضت لأي أنواع من الأذى والكذا.
We were beaten. They were just stripped us from our clothes. They just kept us in a basement. They beat us, they insulted us, so that's why I decided to never go again.
If I said now,
I want to cross the border from Turkey to Bulgaria. How easy would it be? How quick would it be to get that organised?
You should have the money and you should ask and really investigate the issue. Which smuggler is best? You should ask by going to the internet. You can go to TikTok. They even have accounts. They do live streams on TikTok. So you should ask about that. They had the information from the people who arrived. They send a reference. This smuggler was good, so you can go with him.
This sounds like shopping on the internet for a new TV. You get a review, you get a recommendation, you ask your friends. That's how you decide which people smuggler to use.
Exactly, it's like that. We ask many people, not just one review, we ask two, three, maybe four people before talking to the smuggler. Is he really serious about this job?
Mohammed wants to leave because he no longer feels welcome in Turkey. President Erdogan has said it's time his country's guests went home. Migrants without papers are being arrested and deported. Even those with them can face being harassed and abused. My guide to the changing mood here is another Syrian refugee, Hassan. Hi.
Hello.
Hassan.
Welcome to Fatih.
This is the bazaar.
This is the bazaar of Fatih. It's a bit crowded right now after the Friday's prayer. You can see the Syrian shops here. Many of these shops were not here in 2015. After that, this street really changed. This bazaar really changed. You have falafel, you have shawarma, you have many shops that is Syrian food.
Welcome.
Do you recognize these tins?
Yes, it made some nostalgic memories because you have many things, the same design, the same colors. So this is really good.
Let's go in. Hi.
How are you?
This is beautiful. And what is it? It's not a cake. Full of pistachios. What is this?
Halwa for the sweet.
No, it's halwa. No. Mm. How long have you lived here in Istanbul?
Before 10 years. I like Turkey and I stay here and I speak Turkish. For me, don't have any problem. But for Suriyeli people, I think have some problem. Yeah.
They get hassle? Mm. So Hassan, it's not just the halva is sweet. He feels sweet about living in Turkey still.
Yeah, because he just adapted with the situation. He has his small shop. Also, he said something very important, that many people here are afraid of many foreigners or refugees coming to their country. So they are a bit cautious, a bit afraid.
And now it looks like a safe place for Syrians to live. But is it?
It was a comfortable, safe place for Syrians. But in the past few, let's say, years, it's not safe anymore for many Syrians. They're just feared of some groups of racist people who don't like refugees. Even the normal community here, they are not welcoming them. Because especially in the public transportation, let's say you're going in the tram, you cannot speak comfortably in Arabic with your phone because many incidents happened. People attacked because they were speaking Arabic on the phone. So this was real issue for many Syrians here. So they cannot speak Arabic in public comfortably.
The mood here has changed, and changed dramatically. A once warm welcome for refugees has turned into a hope they'll leave at best, and at worst, outright hostility. Emma Sinclair Webb's lived in this city for 14 years. She works for Human Rights Watch.
Previous Erdogan governments did the right thing in accepting refugees. They played an enormous role in protecting Syrians from the terrible civil war in Syria. You know, being in Turkey gave Syrians some kind of chance of a future and stability. That has gone because politically the atmosphere has changed. However, the situation in Syria is still so dangerous, and it's so dangerous for people to be sent back there.
And has it changed partly because there's now an openly anti-refugee party?
Yes, there's certainly an anti-refugee party that's pulled everything to the right and has a xenophobic discourse, which it's proud of. Things that in the past were not sayable are now stated out loud. Hatred of foreigners, hatred of refugees, an idea that you should go back to Syria, go back to Afghanistan. A particularly shocking illustration of this is a party in Turkey called the Victory Party, which had at one stage a logo of a bus. And this bus was to signify that they would send Syrians to Syria by bus.
We're not a very subtle party, and that's why we have a following that's amassing. We're growing.
The vice chair of that party with the bus as a logo, Nezi Karaman, admits his party is small, but he tells me it's growing fast.
Getting more people
and speaks for many, many Turks.
It's a terrible tragedy what the Syrians witnessed. Turkey did a great job back in the day allowing these migrants, these refugees, to seek refuge in our country under temporary protection status. But now there's no war anymore. And it seems that Assad is not going anywhere, and Assad has issued several decrees pardoning the people that fled the country. And I know where you're going to come. Can they trust Assad? Well, that's not a problem. I mean, the war is over, and they have to go back.
Customers of the people smugglers have a choice about how to reach Europe, land or sea. Those who don't walk over the mountains to Bulgaria go instead by boat to Greece. In a Syrian restaurant over a dinner of maklaba,
it smells very good.
Ali, who was a footballer in Damascus before the war forced him to leave, shows me the videos on his phone that promise a route to a better life.
Telegram, hatta Facebook, hatta Instagram موجود يعني.
TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. You have messages about how to get out.
Yeah.
So that's shown Greece, is it?
Yeah. On this island. Yunan.
Smugglers account on TikTok. You have many smugglers having accounts on TikTok.
And it has a smart logo. There's a picture of a boat. There's a picture of a plane. And then there's a map showing some people who've obviously arrived in Greece.
This logo and the picture is to confirm to the audience that we already arrived. I'm sharing my location.
He is celebrating that he has left Turkey and he's got to Europe.
It's tough
here in Turkey, especially if you don't have a degree. Also, you have risks of being deported because now I have a different ID, which I cannot stay in Istanbul. It's a different province, so I cannot work legally here. You have many risks of being stopped by the police here.
So are you now planning to leave Turkey?
Of course, I'm thinking about, absolutely, I'm thinking about leaving. Not just me, all my friends. This is what we are talking all about right now.
So, Ali, if you can go anywhere, where would you like to go?
Holland. Germany. Britain.
Britain. You might want to come to Britain.
Yeah.
What Ali says, what this country shows, is there are always new reasons people feel they want, they need, to head to Europe, to head to Britain. Governments can make big promises to stop the boats or smash the gangs. What they can't do is stop the demand from people who believe it's only by moving they can get a better life. In a little while, we'll be talking to the Director of Operations at the National Crime Agency. We would have liked to have talked to the Turkish government, or indeed a member of President Erdogan's political party, the AKP, but unfortunately no one was available to be interviewed.
Thank you, Nick. We'll talk, you and I, about migration before the end of the programme. But now, 24 minutes past eight, let's turn to domestic concern for many families and children across this country. How do we fix children's care in Britain. Nobody thinks the current situation is what you could call a British success story. Spending by local authorities, already under huge financial pressure on children in care, rose by 42% in the decade to 2022, reaching £11.1 billion. It's projected to rise much further and fast, growing to £14.1 billion in this financial year. Meanwhile, a 2022 report from the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, suggested that the 15 largest care home providers made an average profit of around 23%. Well, today, there is a big package of reforms being announced by the government. The biggest private providers of children's care will have to share much more of their financial performance with the government. There'll be a so-called backstop law, which will limit the profit that providers can make. And there are also plans to give families much greater rights in making decisions about who goes into care and improving support for those who leave the system. Let's speak to Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, who joins us from Westminster. Ms. Phillipson, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So when you started out with this job, this would have been one of the most dense, toughest policy areas. What's your analysis of what's been going wrong in the sector?
This was an urgent priority for change, and that's why the reform that I'm setting out today is the biggest reform in a generation of children's social care. What was very clear to me from opposition and became even more clear from government was that we are badly letting down some of the most vulnerable children in our country who don't have the outcomes that they deserve, who are often in unsuitable accommodation and placements that don't deliver the life chances they deserve. We also see far too many children entering the care system to begin with. And that's why I'm setting out today more support to allow families to stay together where possible, offer wider family networks to get involved and to help care for children, so kinship carers. Also more support around fostering too, because we've got to bring down the numbers of children going into the system. But for those who do, they deserve a lot better. And that's why we will bring forward proposals to crack down on the excessive profiteering that we see from some private providers. If they don't respond, then we will cap their profits, because this scandal has gone on for far too long.
It's interesting you use that word, profiteering. It's in the release today as well. Profiteering is excessive or unfair profit. And just so people know, there's over 80,000 kids in care in this country. And the average amount made, we were told just before 7 o'clock on this programme, the average amount of profit made per child is something like £45,000, which is quite an extraordinary figure. How is it, in your view, that that level of profit has affected performance? Because some people would say, well, profit's fine if the performance is good. But in your view, the profit's been very high and the performance very bad.
This has been allowed to drift for more than a decade. As you say, the costs are astronomical, increasingly bankrupting councils. But alongside that, delivering terrible outcomes for children. I mean, we are talking about some of the most vulnerable children in our country, some of whom will have experienced childhood trauma, have witnessed violence, or have been on the receiving end of terrible abuse. And then to be in a situation where private providers are able to make 20 to 30% profit off the back of that, I think is shocking, and we're not going to stand for it.
And so that's the problem. You outline very clearly the scale of the problem. As I say, no one could imagine this is a success story. Can we turn to the solutions? There's a lot in the reforms today, particularly on financial transparency. Can I ask you specifically about social care workers, the people that work with these kids? They do some of the most important, some of the most noble, some of the most undervalued work in our society. What are you going to do to raise their pay and status?
Workers in social care do a tremendous job and have faced extraordinary pressure in recent years. So that's the wider workforce, including our social workers. What we need to do primarily is to break this cycle of crisis intervention. So move support to the earliest possible point in the lives of children and families, where social workers want to be supporting families to prevent crisis from developing, to prevent problems from escalating. That's why in the budget we committed the single biggest ever investment into kinship care and more support too, alongside fostering. But we do want to work with the workforce to make this change happen. And what I'm also going to be setting out today are further steps to make sure that we see less use of agency social workers in particular. But I'll be setting out a full statement today in the House of Commons with a command paper, a policy statement behind it, that will set out an extensive range of measures where we urgently need to act, where the last government failed to act, and where as a result thousands of children, very vulnerable children across our country, have had their life chances damaged.
Would you like by the end of this Parliament for much more of this sector, whether it's 80,000 or fewer or more children, but much more of this sector to be managed by not-for-profit?
Yes, and we are determined to invest in that, both in terms of support for councils so they can do so directly or with charities or other organisations.
But that requires even more money from government, doesn't it? I mean, nothing wrong with that. I mean, you might say it's an important priority, and obviously these are very vulnerable kids. But if you're going to get not-for-profits going, you need to give them the investment up front, which is even more government money.
I'll be setting out further measures today in the statement that I make to Parliament. But what I would say is that if we continue on the path we're on now, the cost will continue to spiral. We've got to spend more upfront on early intervention and support, but also crack down on this excessive profiteering, which means we are spending ever more money on a system that just isn't delivering. So we this year will be investing more in placements for children delivered through local authorities. Many local authorities are already taking such action, but we as a government will be backing them and backing them to work together on a regional basis to better support placements and to stop this, you know, the unsuitable use of placements, often unregistered placements. And we'll be giving Ofsted tougher powers to crack down on that too.
Okay, well, we'll continue to take a very close interest in this policy. As you say, it does affect some of the most vulnerable children in our society. Can I turn to another subject, which is obviously front and centre for Parliament, but also for many of our listeners, which is assisted suicide. May I ask how you're minded to vote on the matter?
As you will know, the government takes a neutral position on this, so it's for individual members of Parliament to arrive at their own conclusion, to come to their own view as individuals. Back in 2015, when this was last before Parliament, I voted against the measure, and in that time I haven't changed my mind.
What's your thinking?
So I'll be honest with you, I don't want to get into too much of the detail of it, not because I'm seeking to avoid your question, but because I think it is right that individual members of Parliament are able to consider this, and because the government takes a neutral position, I've got to approach it in a responsible way. Primarily, the views I held then are the views I hold now, which is around making sure that there are safeguards in place to stop there being any suggestion of coercion. Now, those setting forward the legislation would argue that the legislation delivers that, and it's for individual members of Parliament to consider on balance how they arrive at these matters. These are difficult, you know, sensitive and emotive issues, and these are for each of us as individuals to reach a conclusion.
Absolutely, and obviously they're extremely finely balanced arguments both ways, but how do you reconcile what you say on the one hand about the government needing to uphold neutrality with the fact that you've also just said how you're going to vote?
Well, because if you ask me a question and I'll answer it, you know, I'm not, you know, it would be
I thought you could withhold it and you could do what some other cabinet ministers have done, which is, I'm not trying to lay a trap, I'm very keen to know that which way you are voting, but, but Harriet Harman said an hour ago on this programme that she thought Wes Streeting's intervention was not particularly helpful. And some people say, we've now got, you know, two people who've said in public who are cabinet members that they're voting against the bill. It's quite hard to reconcile that with government neutrality.
You know, different members of the cabinet, as across government, as with backbench MPs, will have different opinions on this matter. Some members of the cabinet have set out their views in one direction, some in the other. I do, you know, feel that it's important to answer that question directly when asked, because I think it would appear odd were I not to do so in the way that you have framed this question live on air. But in the answers that I'm giving to you, I'm seeking to do so in a way that is balanced, understands the good intentions, you know, where MPs approach this issue and recognise the different opinions that people will hold for very good reason.
Always appreciate direct answers to questions, as you know, and appreciate your time this morning on a busy day for you. Bridget Phillipson, Education Secretary, thank you.
It's 27 minutes to nine. Here's Cathy with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. England's men's footballers return to the top tier of the Nations League after a 5-0 win over the Republic of Ireland. The match at Wembley was Lee Carsley's fifth win in six games as interim manager before Thomas Tuchel takes over on January the 1st. Scotland face Poland in Warsaw tonight, where they will still have a chance of maintaining their Ligue 1 status, and Northern Ireland need a draw to secure top spot in their group and earn promotion to the second tier. Now, the four-time major champion Rory McIlroy has won golf's season-ending DP World Tour Championship in Dubai to top the European Tour's season rankings for a third year in a row. I've been speaking to The Times sports writer Rick Broadbent, who is in Dubai, about McIlroy's title-winning finish to the season.
I think there's a huge amount of relief. I mean, he's had a few near misses, but the one at the US Open back in June really stung, when he seemed to have that fifth major in the bag, one hand sort of on the trophy, and then by virtue of a couple of missed short putts and Bryson DeChambeau doing something incredible, he missed out, and that really stung. To get over the line in his last tournament of the year, yeah, it is significant, and it also draws him level with Seve Ballesteros with six Order of Merits, which is a season-long points race. So yeah, it was a interesting day yesterday.
The interview that McIlroy did straight after coming off the course, he was incredibly emotional. It was particularly that mention of equaling Seve Ballesteros' record. Why is it so important to McIlroy?
All the European Tour players, especially the Ryder Cup players sort of have this deep sort of affection, love even for Seve and what he did for the Ryder Cup. And I think this week in particular, it was quite telling in a way, because there'd been the story about American players getting paid for the first time in the Ryder Cup next year. And I think that might have played a little part into it as well. Rory came out and was very strong against that, saying that he would actually pay to play in the Ryder Cup. So I think that sort of fed into it as well. But he also references off-course problems. I mean, he filed for divorce earlier this year and then reconciled with his wife. So he's had a lot going on and off the course. So a happy ending to the year, I think. Yeah, it was probably all those things sort of fed into those tears.
As we are at the end of the season, from what you know, is there much concern amongst those in charge of golf about the drop in viewing figures? Whether you include the majors or not, there has been a decline of around 20% in those numbers, hasn't there?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, there's no doubt the tour, especially the PGA Tour in America, has been weakened by the whole LIV Golf revolution. Players like Jon Rahm, Brooks Koepka going over there and not playing in PGA Tour anymore. So the game's divided. As a result, it's diluted. And as a result, it's not quite as attractive to viewers, albeit the DP World Tour has had an amazing finish in the last few weeks, and they're quite bullish about their figures. But there is talk of this merger. It's been going on for years really now between Saudi Public Investment Fund, the PGA Tour, and the DP World Tour on the other side. That seems to be moving. Donald Trump had meetings with the commissioner of the PGA Tour and the chairman of Public Investment Fund over the weekend. So he might be the one that's knocking heads together.
He famously said he would sort it all out in 15 minutes,
did.
I think.
Yeah.
Rick Broadbent, thank
Inside
you.
Inside 15 minutes.
Inside 15 yeah. minutes. Rick Broadbent, thank you very much.
Thanks, Cathy.
Couple of other headlines for you. Wales suffered a 52-20 defeat to Australia in Cardiff in Rugby Union's Autumn International Series. Tennis and Great Britain's Billie Jean King Cup team have reached the semi-finals of the competition after defeating the defending champions Canada, and the fifth T20 of the series between England's men's cricketers and West Indies was washed out by heavy rain in St Lucia. England win the T20 series 3-1.
Which, as you said, made you very happy, Carl.
It was schadenfreude.
Good to know that we've got the same weather as St Lucia. 24 minutes to 9, and at 9 o'clock, Tom Sutcliffe is going to start the week for us. What you got, Tom?
Morning, Amal. We've got power and its servants this week, from gentlemen of the bedchamber and privy councillors to today's super spads and unelected advisers. The director, Peter Kosminski, is with us to talk about the fall of Thomas Cromwell, brilliantly captured in season 2 of the television adaptation of Wolf Hall. And he's joined by the award-winning biographer Lucy Hughes-Hallett, whose new book is about the glittering firework career of the Duke of Buckingham, beloved of two kings, but eventually hated by the whole country. And the political journalist Stephen Bush is with us too, a connoisseur of today's networks of power and influence, and occasionally hubris too. That's start of the week, just after 9.
Tom, thank you. The weather here in Bulgaria is not quite like St Lucia. They've just put another log on the furnace in our little community centre in the small village of Shtip. Back at home, cloud in the west and south with outbreaks of rain in the afternoon. Cold and bright everywhere else.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds with Nick Robinson on the border between Bulgaria and Turkey, and Amal Rajan in our studio in London, where I'm joined by Tom Sanders, who has a summary of the news.
The UK and France are expected to follow America's lead and begin allowing Ukraine to use long-range missiles supplied by the West to strike targets deep inside Russia. US officials said President Biden had given Kiev the go-ahead for American missiles to be used after months of refusal by Washington. There's been an angry reaction from Russian politicians, but no response so far from President Putin. So Keir Starmer will become the first British Prime Minister in more than 6 years to meet President Xi Jinping of China this morning. The two leaders will hold talks at the G20 summit in Brazil. BBC News has found that gynaecology waiting lists across the UK have more than doubled since early 2020. There are more than 750,000 outstanding appointments. Before the pandemic, the figure stood at 360,000. Domestic energy prices are expected to edge up again in the new year. The forecaster Cornwall Insight said a household using a typical amount of gas and electricity would pay £1,736 a year, a 1% increase. The regulator Ofgem will announce the next quarterly price cap on Friday.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. It's 21 minutes to 9. You may have heard of Britain's nuclear bomb scandal. This is the story of how, in the 1950s and 1960s, around 39,000 British and Commonwealth servicemen witnessed 45 atomic and hydrogen bombs and hundreds of radioactive experiments, leading to debilitating health conditions that have blighted their lives for decades.
This is the longest-running scandal in British history.
There is nothing bigger or worse than what's happened to the nuclear veterans.
In the heart of the atom's destructive power, there lay the antidote to the threat of war, the great deterrent.
By 75 seconds.
The world doesn't know. I've been fighting this battle for 63 years.
The British state have gaslighted these men.
The development of nuclear weapons marched ahead.
60 seconds.
It was really frightening. We thought we were going to die.
Well, that's a clip from a documentary on the BBC on Wednesday. It's called Britain's Nuclear Bomb Scandal, Our Story. It's very powerful, as you can hear. And it's presented by Susie Boniface, a journalist who has long worked for the Daily Mirror titles that has campaigned on this subject. And it also features John Morris, one of the affected veterans. We can speak to both of them now. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning.
Susie, if I could just start with you. We've become rather accustomed to long-running scandals in this country, but this really is the longest of them all.
This is like the proto-scandal. Because, you know, 70 years ago, someone somewhere made a decision that these men should be used in what amounts now to, I can see, as a human experiment. And when I started reporting on this nearly 20 years ago, the veterans all said to me, well, we were guinea pigs. And I thought, well, yeah, there's no evidence of that, really. I can understand why you think that. You've obviously been used negligently, but there was no evidence of human experimentation. But then a couple of years ago, I was passed a secret document from 1958 about the blood tests of a squadron leader who was sent into the mushroom clouds to sample the clouds for evidence for the scientists. And from that, we had a trail of breadcrumbs, which now over the past 2 years, we've got to the point where, as we report in the Mirror today, there are serving officials currently in high-up jobs in Whitehall who are implicated in a multi-departmental cover-up. So far, we've got the Foreign Office, the Ministry of Defence, the Atomic Weapons Establishment and the Government Legal Department, all with questions to answer about potential crimes of misconduct in public office, because officials have given sworn false testimony to multiple courts over decades that these blood tests never took place, and we now have evidence, 4,000 pages of evidence that they did.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that scandal in a minute, but first, this is the human, before we get to the cover-up, the human cost. I mean, John, you're 86 now. I think you were just 18 when you were sent to Christmas Island in 1956. What did you see and do there?
I was on national service, and you were ordered to go to wherever post they sent you, and I finished up on Christmas Island. Age 18, never been out of a place called Little Lever in all my life. I didn't even know where Christmas Island was. And I was a laundry operator washing the clothes for the servicemen that were building, as we were told initially, a runway for planes.
And this had a dreadful effect on your life, didn't it, John? Because apart from anything else, I read that you lost a son, Stephen, who was just... was he just 4 months old when he died?
He was 4 months old.
So sorry.
And when you've watched the documentary, you will see so many stories that are similar of people who've lost children, wives that have had miscarriages, but Stephen died aged 4 months. I've told the story many times. I was arrested for possible murder under caution. 3 days later, they said it was a cot death. Shortly after, I got the death certificate, and it was pneumonia.
And he died in, as you say, pneumonia in 1962. And just to be clear, John, you were refused a war pension. So, I mean, what would you like to see by way of compensation now?
This is coming back to where Susie's mentioned. I appeal for a war pension. I could not get my blood records or my urine records. And I know that I had those taken at least five times. I was in an isolation hospital on Christmas Island, along with about 200 others. And I wanted to get those records so I could prove that I'd been contaminated. I have a letter that says, yes, we agree, John, you were contaminated with radiation, but the cancers or the disorders you've got do not warrant a pension. In other words, I got the wrong cancer. And I would like desperately to meet Keir Starmer. He promised me in 2021 he would meet me. I wish, Keir, for you to honour that promise, so that we can find a pathway forward.
Well, I have absolutely no doubt that people in his office will be listening to you now, so they hear your message loud and clear. Susie, if I could just finish with you, I hope this doesn't seem an indelicate thing to say, but some of the other inquiries that we've had in public life in this country have taken a decade, and there are some people like John who may not want to wait a decade in order to get both the answers and the compensation they need.
Exactly, and our public inquiry system in this country is clearly broken. If Windrush and Grenfell and all the others are taking more than a decade to get somewhere, it's basically a system of just pushing things into the long grass. We've now got about 10% of the men who took part in this who are still alive. By definition, they're the least affected, but they are having to run a crowdfunder to fund their own civil case to sue the Ministry of Defence for these blood records that it says it doesn't have. And since May, their legal team have provided the MOD with an alternative to a really expensive public inquiry that would take too long, which is a special one-year special tribunal, like a mini inquiry, if you like, where a judge could investigate this issue solely of the cover-ups, not the nuclear bomb test, that's gone, but solely of the cover-up and what's gone wrong since then. People who are alive right now working in government, and if they are not called to account or even as interviewed as witnesses into what's gone wrong here, then it can potentially happen again and again and again.
Susie Boniface, and before that, John Morris, thank you both very much indeed. I should say the documentary is called Britain's Nuclear Bomb Scandal, Our Story, and it's on BBC Two on Wednesday at 9 p.m. and also on the iPlayer.
It's 14 minutes to nine now. In the past couple of hours, we've heard the stories of migrants planning to leave Turkey and head to Europe. We've heard the TikTok videos of the people smugglers who charge thousands of dollars for every attempted journey. Once into the EU, some of those migrants may choose to head to the Channel to make one last risky journey to Britain. It is the job of the NCA, the National Crime Agency, to try and frustrate the people smugglers, to arrest them, disrupt their gangs. And last week, the Prime Minister hailed the arrest of a major supplier of the boats used to make those crossings, a Turkish national detained at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. Many of the boats are made in Turkey, just across the border from where I am broadcasting this morning in Bulgaria. Well, we're joined by the Director of Operations at the National Crime Agency, Rob Jones. Good morning to you, Mr. Jones.
Morning, Nick.
Does the key to tackling the problem on the Channel often lie many hundreds of miles away, for example, where I am this morning?
It absolutely does. The region that you're in at the moment is the crucible for organised immigration crime, where facilitators meet migrants and those who are involved in the smuggling model. Their logistics bring the consignments of boats and migrants together and bring them through to the beaches of northern France.
You had this major arrest last week. How significant was it?
It's significant because it recognises the significance of the organised crime groups who've industrialised this model. And if you look at the numbers and what happened between 2020 and 2021, the numbers increased dramatically, and that coincided with us sighting for the first time vessels that had been used in the central Mediterranean route. That type of vessel is extremely dangerous. There's no legitimate use for it, and it was pioneered by organised crime groups in Turkey who have then imported that business model to the English Channel.
Now, as well as Turkey, which we know you're focused on, there's a focus on Kurdistan, isn't there? Earlier this month, a man was sentenced in Britain to 17 years in prison for his role, a man called Zada, who was based in Preston in Lancashire. How important is Kurdistan, then, as a route of the sort of trouble that you're dealing with?
It is important because many of the organised crime groups have a strong footprint there. Zada is a good example of that type of individual. He plied his wares on social media very publicly. Ultimately, that social media led to his downfall, and he's now got 17 years in prison as a result of that.
Now, your job is to cooperate, I imagine, with border control, with police forces and so on. You're not a politician, but is there a role for Britain in subsidising the efforts that are made in Kurdistan, in Turkey, in Bulgaria, elsewhere, in working directly to help them with their intelligence and border control?
So the NCA focuses the organised crime business model, which we're working to collapse by targeting the money, the logistics and those that move migrants and exploit them through that route. It's for others to pursue policies which might ultimately result in deterrence. And of course, we welcome anything which will discourage people from making those dangerous crossings.
Now, sometimes people compare the war with the war, in inverted commas, with people smugglers, with the war on drugs. there's an argument that it's harder, though, Mr. Jones, isn't there? That actually sometimes cash is not involved in people smuggling, for reasons you understand and maybe can explain, and the gangs are that much more informal than they have to be in the drugs trade.
It is harder, it's different, it's more organic, it's distributed, and it relies on a series of informal, trusted relationships. The money model utilises Hawala, which is a model built on trust and informality, and that means that we don't have large amounts of cash moving between borders or even electronically like we do with the drug trade. So it's different in that regard. It's also different because it utilises ubiquitous social media apps, which allow people to be handed between groups at ease. So it's a much more distributed or organic model, which is different from the drug trade. The crucial thing is the ingredients aren't illegal to possess. It's illegal to possess drugs and you can seize them. Most of the small boats business model is dual use, lawful items, which it's not illegal for you to possess. And that's one of the challenges that we're facing.
That leads me finally to a difficult question. Isn't it an illusion to think you can win the, in inverted commas, war on people smuggling? In the way that, frankly, we're never going to win the war on drugs. It's just not possible. You can curb it, you can limit it, you can try and control it. You're never going to beat it.
So we work really hard across a range of serious organised crime threats to prevent harm to the public and to prevent the exploitation of the vulnerable. And that's top of our list with all of our efforts in dealing with crime and organised crime. We simply must do something to reduce the capacity that's been created by organised crime in the English Channel. And that is a worthy cause, and it's something that we're all committed to. The capacity was created by these unlawful boats, which meant that organised crime groups could move three or four times the amount of people that they could before they started using them. By reducing that capacity, we start to reduce the harm and we begin to take some of the risk out of those movements. We'll always look at the riskiest routes, and that's why small boats is important to us.
Rob Jones, Director of Operations at the NCA. Thank you very much indeed. Important word there, reduce.
8 minutes to 9, Leeds Playhouse is the place to be tonight. It's there that a tour begins of the stage adaptation of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, based on C.S. Lewis's 1950 children's fantasy novel. It follows those four children who evacuate wartime London to stay in the countryside, where they find a wardrobe that is a portal to Narnia. What is the enduring appeal of this allegorical work, and how does its story of escape from war and the vanquishing of the White Witch answer enduring human needs? Well, Michael Fentiman is the director of the play, and Michael Ward is the academic and theologian from the University of Oxford, who's also the author of the award-winning Planet Narnia, The Seven Heavens in the Imagination of C.S. Lewis. Michael and Michael, good morning.
Good morning.
Michael Fentiman, if I could start with you. It's very striking, isn't it, that Lewis wrote in a time of war where the urge was to escape, to get out, was strong. And in a sense, we all felt something of that urge in the pandemic, which I presume is when you started work on this.
Yeah, we were developing this enormous story over Zoom for a good 9 months, and at various different points in our first little inception of this production, we were plunged into darkness, so to speak, and having to sort of pause for moments. But you know, what I find special about the material is, I think it, when you're young, it makes you feel like you wish to be transformed and transported, and then when you're old, you wish to be transported to being young again. And there's something in these stories that I feel contains the magic and possibility of both, and pulling us out of darker times seems to be also part of that.
And Michael Ward, in the end, the thing about this book is it does have that very rare power that great literature has of working on so many different levels, doesn't it? So, like Orwell's Animal Farm, you know, my 8-year-old son could read it and love it. And for you, and forgive me for saying, but you're no longer 8 years old, is repaid study over decades.
That's right, yes. Like all classic works of fiction for children, and indeed films and plays, children can enjoy it for the simple story, the adventure with witches and dragons and battles and adventures. And adults can enjoy it for all sorts of additional levels of moral, religious meaning, literary depths, literary allusions. Narnia really is a work of genius because it works on many, many different registers at once.
And Michael Ward, you inhabited Lewis's life and study, didn't you? I mean, I think you literally stayed in his former home in Oxford, the home where he died. I think Lewis's bedroom and study was also yours for a time. What do you think, having inhabited Lewis's life in that way, what do you think Lewis meant when he said he felt he had to write the line, "The Witch in the Wardrobe," else he would burst?
That's right. That's how he described the origin of the composition of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. There came a year in my life when I was about 40, he said, when I felt I must write a story for children or I would burst. And I think one of the occasioning reasons was the fact that at the start of the Second World War, various children from London were evacuated to his house in Oxford. And he had a number of school children living there throughout that conflict.
Right, and Michael Fentiman, the whole plot does burst. I mean, the book has this completely unstoppable, it's almost an overwhelming rhythm, doesn't it? There is so much character, so much plot, to use that old dichotomy from Aristotle's Poetics. How do you convey all that on the stage?
Well, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, we're going to tour all up and down the country and visit every major city, hopefully, over the next, definitely over the next year or so. And we're a bit of a first, because we want to try and honour every single page and every single beat and magic of Lewis's book, and that then creates an enormous production that every single page you get to, you suddenly have to conjure something that almost seems impossible. But we feel like, hopefully, we've managed to get closer to conjuring the impossible in a almost C.S. Lewis-like leap of faith.
Well, good for you. And I hope tickets are still available for Leeds tonight. And indeed, best luck with all your regional performances.
Get in there quick.
Exactly. There won't be many tickets left, especially after this, I tell you. But Michael Ward, if I could just ask a final thought to you. I think you had a role, a minor role, if you don't mind me saying, in Shadowlands, that great, I think it was 1986 film with Anthony Hopkins, about the life of Lewis. There is an upcoming Narnia film. It's being made by Greta Gerwig. Have you been approached? And if not, would you like a part?
I haven't been approached yet, and I would love to be involved in some capacity or other, either behind the camera or in front of it.
Okay,
so, well, if Greta Gerwig is listening to this, call me.
Well, she's almost certainly listening, because anyone who's anyone is always listening to the Today programme. Michael Fentiman, good luck with the play. Michael Ward, thank you very much for your time, and also best of luck with that phone call from Greta Gerwig.
Just a couple of minutes before we go. In this morning, start the week at 9, Tom Sutcliffe leads a debate on the rise and fall of the political fixer with his guests, the director of the new BBC drama Wolf Hall, biographer Lucy Hughes Hallett, and FT columnist Stephen Bush. That's after the news at 9.
And we should say, shouldn't we, Nick, that straight after Wednesday's programme, you're going to be speaking to me live on this live recording of the podcast. We had a little experiment with this a couple of weeks ago, and it went rather well. So we've got a live recording of the Today podcast. It's on BBC Sounds. We're going to talk more about what Nick and the team he's with have learnt from his reporting, and try and answer some of your questions about what it's like taking Today on the road, and also maybe what you to do about migration. So please do get in touch with your questions. The best way to get in touch is via WhatsApp. Send us a message to +44 330 123 4346. That's +44 330 123 4346, or you can email us at today@bbc.co.uk. So you can hear that at 9 a.m. on Wednesday on the live news stream at the top of BBC Sounds. So if you download the BBC Sounds app, look across the top, there's a kind of live dial, toggle it to the right, it will say live news, and as if by magic, Nick, you'll have even more of Nick Robinson in Europe in our lives. And I was very struck, Nick, I should just say, that interview you just did with Rob Jones from the National Crime Agency, he said that where you are is the crucible of this issue, and when you pushed him on whether or not it could actually be solved, he was honest. I mean, he had to answer the way he did, but he was honest. It's not a problem you can solve, it's one you manage.
That's right. He talked about reducing it, didn't he? And many people would be in favour of that, both for humanitarian reasons, for saving the lives of people who risk their lives crossing the channel in overcrowded small boats that are not fit to make the journey, but also because they think that borders should be controlled. But it is an effort, in other words, that spreads many hundreds of miles. Yes, here to Turkey and Bulgaria, and on Wednesday we'll be presenting the programme from the border crossing itself, where British money is being spent to help the Bulgarian police to check the backs of lorries, to check the lorries that are bringing boats across as well as migrants, in order to try and to frustrate the trade. And then later in the week, we're travelling to Germany, a country that, like Turkey, threw its arms open to migrants a few years ago, back in 2016. Chancellor Merkel, you may remember, saying, "Dear Schaffen das," where there's a will, she said. Well, the will isn't there anymore. Germany is changing its mind about migration. And that'll be the focus of our programme this Friday on Today.
Yeah, and as you say, the impact and the implications